Marion Mina, National Treasury. Benito, National Treasury.
Did you hear who they said they were? I don't think we did.
Marion Mina, Public Finance, responsible for Home Affairs, National Treasury. Brenda Swart.
All right. Thank you. May we have members introducing themselves?
Morning, everybody.
My name is Anshin Dreyer, member of COPA.
Lorraine Mashiani, COPA.
Vincent Smith. Bafi Tselepule, member of SCOPA.
Pierre John Hazard, member of SCOPA.
Thank you. I'm Comrade Temba Godi. I chair this committee. All right, we want to heartily welcome you, Mr. Shabalala, and your delegation. I hope you will appreciate that our responsibility as the Standing Committee on Public Accounts is to deal with matters financial in the annual reports of departments and public entities. And that in instances where the audit opinions of the Auditor General have very little negative findings, we would, under normal circumstances, not pursue any interaction. But then that if we request an interaction like this, there are clearly areas of concern that we would like to discuss with you. But by and large, to get an understanding and clarity from your side in terms of why certain things happened or why certain things did not happen, and how we can ensure that some of the things that should not happen do not happen in future, so that the report of the department could be a joy to read. Well, kicking off, Mr. Acting Director General, I see you have been acting since October.
Yes.
Well, just switch on the mic so that the recording can be done aside. And we want to request that may we keep our cellular phones off so that they don't affect the recording that side, because we should do transcripts. So if there are disturbances, it affects the recording. Not even on vibration, because when it vibrates, it doesn't affect. So you have been acting since October.
Honorable Chair, yes, from the 2nd of October, 2006.
For how long are you likely to be acting?
Until further notice. Sure.
So it might as well be that you can be acting for the next year, 2 years, 3 years. I mean, it's an open-ended situation. I know it's not in your hand, but I'm just trying to understand the arrangement as they stand currently.
Chairperson, currently it's until further notice, but I think it's highly unlikely that I can continue until the end of the year. I'm not sure, but it seems something is being done in this regard.
I wanted to check if indeed there was something being done. So it seems you're not certain.
Yes, I'm not certain, because that is not my area of expertise, or the prerogative doesn't lie with me. Chairperson, it's with the Honorable Minister.
So as far as you're aware, you're acting, and there is nothing definite on the horizon that would want to put permanency to your position or bring somebody permanent to occupy that position?
Not as far as I know for now,
Chairperson. How would you desire the situation to be? Is this a desirable situation for you? Are you comfortable with the arrangements as they stand?
Chairperson, I would say my acting is about to then keep the ship afloat, and I'm not doing the job alone. I've got colleagues. We are trying our best just to make sure that the department delivers its mandate.
Is the ship afloat or is it sinking?
It's afloat. It's afloat. Definitely it's afloat.
Still afloat or afloat? What I mean, sinking slowly or it's not sinking?
No, it's not sinking at all.
At all
it's not sinking.
Stabilize, stable, everything?
Yeah, we're trying to stabilize the department.
Not stable yet?
In some areas it is stable. In some other areas we're still trying to make it really stable.
I think that has been the situation all along. Some areas have been stable, some areas have not been stable. So it's not saying anything new. Point is, it's not stable.
I won't say it's not stable, Honorable Chair, because as you may know, we have got some challenges in the Department of Home Affairs. The challenges that we have are not new. We are confronting them on a daily basis, but at the same time, we've made some progress, remarkable progress in the department.
Remarkable, you say?
Yes, I'm saying it's a remarkable progress, Honorable Chair.
That's very encouraging to hear, and I hope it is like that. You see, the reason I sort of had an interest in your situation, but you will agree that the department is not has not had sustainable leadership. Would you agree with that in terms of the Director General?
Yes, I agree, but like I'm saying, the management that is there now until such time permanent DG is appointed is trying its best to make sure that we deliver the mandate of the department. In particular, in the mandate of the government at large.
I see. Well, the latter part was not the point. The point was that the department has not had a sustainable leadership. That is, it has been changing leadership quite periodically. And would you not agree that this is not helpful? Or this does affect good governance in the department?
It definitely does. It does. I agree.
Okay.
It does.
All right. Okay. No, fine. I also say that and go ahead. I do hear you talking about the confronting challenges. What I don't know is what the outcome of those confrontations are, whether you succeed or you lose in these confrontations, or it's a stalemate. But one thing that affects not only good governance, but governance generally, I think it's the capacity within the department. Unacceptably high vacancy rates, which would certainly affect the ability of the department to discharge its mandate effectively and efficiently. The last time we checked, you had a 29% vacancy rate. Is that correct?
Yes, it was just like that, Chairperson.
And it has remained that way.
Chairperson, I think we do have the latest statistics. Maybe if we can share with the honorable.
Yes. What are the latest statistics saying in terms of vacancy rates?
Chairperson, if the chair allows, I would then ask my DDG Corporate Services responsible, among other things, HR, just to give a breakdown as to where.
No. I just want to figure out. I just took an overall figure of 9%. If this has changed, if it has worsened 40%, just say 40%. If it has improved to 15%, just say 15%. Then I think the committee will have a sense that indeed there has been a positive or negative movement.
According to the information that I got, is that it hasn't changed much.
It hasn't changed much.
Yeah, it hasn't changed much.
It's changed slightly.
Slightly, the honorable.
For the better or for the worse?
For the better.
Yeah. Ah, I see. What will be slightly? Because I suppose they should give you definite figures. From 29.3%, what percentage do we have? If you can give me a figure, yes, by all means. I'll only be too happy to hear from her. I'm saying, if you can give me a definitive figure, yes, by...
Thank you, Chairperson. we had a total filled post of about, of not about, of 60963. Out of a total establishment of 10,100, and the vacancies that we had is 3504.
3504. That is 3,504.
Yes.
So the situation has, all intents and purposes, not changed. Because the figures I have in front of me say you had a staff establishment of 9,853, and you had filled for 6,963, and vacancies of 2,890. So it means actually the situation is worse, because now you have a vacancy rate of 3,504.
That's what we have.
Okay. All right. No, thank you. So obviously, Mr. KTG, you would agree that the department is facing a very challenging situation. Now, that being the case, are there any measures in place, even if purely at a conceptual level? Because clearly from what I have now, things have just gone from bad to worse instead of improving. How do you intend to stop this lie? That's why I was asking, is the ship afloat or sinking, or still sinking, or still afloat? And from these figures, it tells me that in terms of the capacity of the department, in terms of the warm bodies that the department needs to be able to discharge of its function, it is having a serious challenge.
Yeah, it is, Chairperson. But I think let us just put this issue in perspective. The vacancy rate that we have is correct, the figure that the DDG Corporate Services has given the Honorable Chair. But then some of those posts are not funded. The posts have been created, the establishment has been approved, but not funded. What is going to happen is that we are going to phase in terms of the MTEF process. We have got a certain number of posts that we are going to be filling this current financial year. It's staggered for 3 years.
Let me check. Do you have an idea of how many of these posts are unfunded? If I can check with the DDG, I think if she can give me the figure.
Chairperson, The funded posts, the newly funded posts from the new creations were at 885 posts. And of that 885, we had filled 625. And these were newly funded posts during the year under review 05-06.
So,
the establishment has got newly created posts which are funded over the MTF period incrementally. So the year under review, the funded posts were 885.
So your 2,619 posts are not funded posts. Would that be the understanding? I'm trying to do some quick arithmetic if I have my figures correct. Because you have 885 posts that are funded.
Yes.
Out of the total vacancy rate of 3,504, so if you subtract that, it will give you 2,619 posts that you say are not funded.
That would include posts that are not funded, but also posts that become vacant through natural attrition. When people resign for various reasons, those posts would actually be funded and ready for filling. So those we fill on an ongoing process. For example, in the year under review, we already filled, in addition to the 625 from the newly created, newly funded posts for 2005-06, we also filled 391. Vacancies which resulted from natural attrition.
Yes.
Honorable Chair, I think that figure is correct to say they were not funded during the financial year under review. Those posts were not funded. Like she has indicated, incrementally. Through the MTF. We have got new posts where those that were not funded are now funded, and within this 3-year period, this post will be filled. If check allows me, I would request our CFO just to make some addition.
Yeah, no. Let's keep the numbers. The numbers speak for themselves. Although I'm getting a bit confused, and I don't want to be confused right at the beginning, otherwise I'll mess up this meeting. Let me check from Mr. Treasurer. What is your understanding of these figures? Because, you see, it becomes problematic when in your staff establishment you include posts that are not funded, and they become part of your vacancy rate. And when we say you have a vacancy rate of 29%, say yes, that's it. But then most of those posts are not funded. But let me hear from National Treasurer. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. The posts, I think this is the way we did it, was that by the year 2008-09, there would be funded posts of 10,534. But in the year under review, we had funded 7,748 posts. 748 posts in the year under review. And the reason for that is, first, there isn't accommodation for those new intakes. So the issue was that you first have to get office space to actually bring in the people. And secondly, with our little experience, is that you cannot actually go out and employ 4,000 people at one go in 1 year. And that was the logic behind funding only 7,748 posts in the year under review. Incrementally then, we end up with 10,534 posts in 2008-09. But the precursor is the accommodation. There isn't accommodation currently for the staff establishment in Home Affairs.
I see. But then, you see, the figures they're giving me imply that the vacancy rate is 785 and not 885. Because 6,963 from 7,748, so that will give you 785. But maybe that's a mute point. Fact is, there are capacity constraints and these do need to be, because if out of 885, let's take 885, you have 625 that are filled, then you are left with about 260 funded posts that have not been filled. You can subtract and add. I think it will come right to that. Now, in the year under review, one of the areas that seemed to be seriously affected was the finance department. And we're here talking financial management and administration. What is the situation currently? And what was the cause of this understaffing within that very, very key and critical department that deals with finances? Because clearly, your provision of services is dependent on finances. And if we're not able to effectively manage those resources, it is definitely going to affect the extent to which we deliver the services. Why was that department understaffed, and what is the situation currently? Mr. Shola.
Thank you. The situation right now is that we still have funded posts and unfunded posts.
Maybe let's put it this way.
Okay.
I'm saying that in the year under review, there's a statement from the Auditor General that your finance department is understaffed. Is that fact or not?
I'll ask CFO to respond to that if the chair allows.
I wanted a yes or no. Is it understaffed or not?
Under the year under review, yes.
It was understaffed.
Yes.
What is the situation currently?
Situation currently, at the head office, yes, we have vacancies, but they are not as much as they were previously. But the challenge, I think the major challenge in terms of understaffing is mainly at our provincial offices. The establishment at our provincial offices is inadequate to deal with the controls, the internal controls in terms of segregation of duties. And during the previous financial year, when the intervention team from DPSA came in, they are working on a study that says, as Home Affairs, with all these cash collection offices, you actually need to review your entire establishment.
In the finance department or general?
Specifically for finance.
Finance.
Oh. Yes, because our levels at finance are currently at the level of senior state accountant. You find few areas where there's assistant director. Now, the issue is there's a problem of supervision. And hence the major challenge is on our revenue collection.
Indeed. I hope you'll agree that in the absence of monitoring and proper supervision, then all sorts of diversions and non-compliance kick in. And that is probably one of the greatest challenges you're facing.
Yes, Chairman.
Right. Alright, I'll come to this later. I see that in one of our earlier resolutions, the scope, we touched on Lindelani. Lindela.
Lindela.
Where we had spoken about inadequate financial management control. Briefly, what do you say the situation is currently?
Chairperson, we've put the problems at Lindela behind our back. Lindela is stable in terms of its financial management. We've dealt with all those control problems, as can be evidenced by the report under review. There are no issues that were raised by
arising from the
previous.
The question of the contract for which was supposed to expire in 2005, how has that been dealt with? Because there were concerns around the need to ensure a proper supply chain management practices in the renewing of the tender. Or awarding of the tender, if you're not renewing, I mean, it's not supposed to be given that Bosasa would have its contract renewed. What happened?
Chairperson, when we interacted with the committee in 2005, May, we promised that indeed we will follow due process on expiry of the tender. In fact, we said even prior to that, we will definitely go out on tender. We will follow the normal evaluation process. We will follow the normal adjudication process. Chairperson, we did exactly that, and we finalized the process timely. As can be recalled, we were also warned not to flout tender procedures, nor to extend the contract, which signifies lack of planning. And we actually did just that. We complied.
No, that's better. Now, in the year under review, there are challenges around your internal audit, its effectiveness, and its resourcefulness. What has been done to address that situation? Because obviously, we'll appreciate the importance of internal audit, so far as it relates to internal controls. Internal controls ensuring compliance, which is always the biggest problem in institutions where policies and procedures have already been developed, but then you have problems of compliance. What is the situation with the internal audit currently?
Chairperson, the situation as far as our internal audit, the structure of internal audit first has been reviewed, and the level has been upped to that of it was normally headed by a director. It's now headed by a chief director, though the post has not been filled currently. And the other intervention is...
When is it going to be filled? Because I think that should be the first intervention. I mean,
yeah,
the head first, otherwise... You will have a headless chicken, so to speak.
Chairperson, we have interviewed, we have made a recommendation for final appointment.
When is that likely to be done?
It's in the hands of the executive authority, but it will be very soon. It will be soon. It won't be months.
All right. What other interventions? You have to go into other interventions.
Other interventions, Chairperson, auditing a department like Home Affairs, which has quite a vast number of offices, might not be carried out with only your core staff. Other means that we've entered into is to co-source with some auditing firms to increase capacity. And the intention is also to transfer skills to the government employed staff members. So we have gone out on tender to sort of do that outsourcing to ensure that all audits are carried out. I think what has been the challenge of internal audit has been they have an audit plan that is normally approved by the audit committee. But you will find that because of a number of inefficiencies that occur in various offices, fraud and corruption, they find themselves diverted to carry out additional assignments. For instance, if there's a financial irregularity somewhere, cash shortages and whatever, you need to divert internal audit to say carry out this assignment because you want to deal with a disciplinary issue here, and you need that sort of due process for the sake of providing evidence. So what we are saying is that we will then separate when we have this added capacity. Through co-sourcing, there will be staff members who will concentrate on the audit plan as it is, and others will also concentrate. There will be a team that concentrate on ad hoc assignments to ensure that the program is not diverted.
All right. Thank you. Okay. I see that in the year under review, the Auditor General feels that an amount of 19 million should have been classified as an irregular expenditure. Is there an explanation why it was not classified as such?
Yes, Chairperson. Chairperson, the amount of 19 million arise from a process that the department followed to acquire expenditure. Chairperson, when we procure goods and services, we procure such goods and services in terms of supply chain management framework, which is also covered in the Treasury Regulation 16A. In terms of this Treasury Regulation, Chairperson, we have to follow normal tender procedures. But in instances where it is impractical to follow tender procedures.
What does that mean? In instances that are impractical?
Well, Section 16A 6.4 says that is left in to the discretion of the accounting office.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it says the accounting office, in instances where it is impractical to invite competitive bids, the accounting officer may procure required goods or services by other means, provided that the reasons for deviating from inviting competitive bids must be recorded and approved by the accounting officer. Now, the issues covered by the Office of the Auditor General as irregular, we don't necessarily see them as irregular because we followed the rule book, because the accounting officer indeed approved deviation.
Yeah, no, the issue here is the impracticality. What was impractical about inviting tenders for this particular procurement?
For instance, Chairperson, the department was faced with the backlog in terms of processing asylum seekers applications. Urgently, we had to acquire buildings, we had to acquire furniture. And that was the pressure that the department was receiving in terms of asylum seekers. The situation was untenable. I mean, we were challenged left, right, and center by the necessary organizations like the UNHCR. In the process of acquiring buildings through normal procedures, we got a building that had no proper facilities, and we had to undergo a process of refurbishment. Which really necessitated deviation to deal with that.
From what you're saying, the situation you are referring to, it's of your own creation. I mean, the pressures that you found yourself in clearly arose from the inefficiencies within the department, probably from poor planning. So I would not be impressed with a regulation that seeks to give a leeway in instances where poor planning puts you in a cash-penetrative situation, where out of your own administrative weaknesses, you find yourself pressured or being caught up with inefficiency or lack of capacity. And then you end up applying that clause. It can become a very good clause for anybody who wants to do things without proper motives. Fester things to fester until they are at boiling point, and then use that clause to deviate from normal practice.
I agree, Chairperson, but that was not really the intention, just to bypass the rule. It was the circumstances that we found.
I agree
that it is indeed subject to misuse, but really the intention at the time was definitely not to bypass tender procedure. I think we did it consciously, and that's why we followed the procedure. Our feeling, by the way, we also checked this with the supply chain management at National Treasury, who actually concurred that, yes, the accounting officer can apply discretion in instances such as those.
I also see that your unauthorized expenditure, unauthorized expenditure for 15 million from prior years, and the year under review, it's almost 100 million. How is this explained? And I still assume that Mr. Shawalala is in charge. So your responses should ordinarily be additional. I could expect him to take personal responsibility for responding to the issues that were raised. Jump from 50 million to almost 100 million, 99.883.
Chairperson, the previous unauthorized expenditure of 15 million is something that we were still hearing with the National Treasury.
Yeah, no, that one I want to put it aside. I was just mentioning it,
yeah.
But my area of focus and emphasis is this 99.
The one for 99 million, Chairperson, is what one can call, though it's not covered anywhere, technical unauthorized expenditure. It is technical in the sense that we exceeded the budget. Let me start by saying the department in the year under review, the department exceeded its budget by 1.75%, which was 53 million. But In looking at the main divisions of the vote in terms of classification of the budget, in terms of capital and current, there was just a challenge where some areas of expenditure were classified as capital, while in fact they were the real expenditure that went through was current expenditure. It's mainly in areas of public works. When there were changes in standard charge of charge.
Now I hear that explanation. What does it want to say finally in relation to this unauthorized expenditure? I say it's a technical unauthorized expenditure, whatever that means. What does it take away from the fact that it's an unauthorized expenditure?
It is technical in the sense that we are not expected as the department to repay the 99 to the fiscal, because it did not definitely affect the fiscal. In a manner in which you deal with unauthorized expenditure, you will require condonation because you've exceeded your budget. But like I say, the only portion that will require that kind of condemnation will be your 53 million.
But you certainly should have explained this to the auditors. If you did it.
We have, but we're not writing their report, Chairperson. We have to the best of our ability. But we don't.
No. It doesn't go that far. All I'm saying is that the explanation you're giving us now is what you probably gave to the auditors, and they still maintain that they. It's unauthorized, technical or not, That's why I was saying, if you say it's technical unauthorized expenditure, what does it take away from the fact that it's unauthorized? What does it change in a substantive term? I hear you. You are saying actually instead of 99, it should be 53 million. That's what you're saying.
Of the elements of unauthorized expenditure is when you have exceeded your vote. And I say, in terms of our vote, we exceeded our vote by 1.75%, which translates to 53 million rand.
So you're saying that about 46 million, as far as you're concerned, it's not the it's not an authorized expenditure.
Yes.
Can we get an explanation from the agent's office? How did you get to lump the 46 million together with the 53 million? 53 million, 46 million, 99 million here, and the gentleman says it's technical. I think the technical unauthorized expenditure should apply to the 46 million because the 53 million, there is agreement. It's unauthorized. So it's the 46 or 45 million that they that are talking about. Is there any explanation?
Well, Jay, in the absence of the actual breakdown of the figures, which we don't have, I mean, I don't quite understand the technical versus non. We were just saying that in terms of the definition of unauthorized expenditure, the full amount was unauthorized, subject to whether Treasury would condone the amount or not.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of the PFMI unauthorized expenditures, overspending of the vote and overspending of a main division. Now, main division is a program. Now, where the technical part comes in that the CFOs refer to is that they've overspent on Program 1 and Program 2, and they've overspent on the budget as a whole. So that overspending on Program 1 and Program 2 is the makes up the 46 million.
So are you saying that indeed the 46 is a technical? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Shane. No, we're saying the whole amount is actually unauthorized expenditure. But I think we need to understand that the Department of Home Affairs asked for a rollover in the previous year of 97 million, right? But because they were chronic underspenders, we put it on a contingency reserve, and we said, come back in August if you still think that you would require this fund so that they could offset whatever came from the previous year. At the end of August, the situation was they only spent about 34% of the current money, and they didn't come back. I don't know why Pat is not saying that they didn't come back. And by the time he came back in January, it was too late for him to get the rollover.
January
2006. Oh. It was too late. But at that point, we also felt that they would still understand. They concurred with us even in January that they thought they would understand by 40 million rand. We thought they would understand by 180 million rand. In March, the spike that happened in the department is actually the cause of the understanding that occurred. Because the bulk of the money was spent in March. A lot of payments, a lot of purchases, a lot of transfers that shocked everybody. They were not aware of it. We picked it up. We went to speak to them about it. They then came back with answers for what had happened. But the reason for the understanding is they had requested the rollover. We thought, they thought they wouldn't need it, but we said, come back in August. They didn't come back because they felt they were going to understand. But in March, things just went way Hawaii. We really don't know what really happened in March, and that's the reason why they're in this position.
Do you know what happened in March? Can you explain what happened in March?
We know what happened throughout the financial year.
What happened in March?
In my position as CFO, I know what happens every month, and the finances are reviewed every month. Chairperson, around March, and we knew that it will happen. The department had procured We had a bad record convention tender, which sort of accelerated in terms of capturing of fingerprints. We were expecting a delivery of 57 actually at that time, mobile units, and they were being manufactured. And indeed, they were delivered between payments started flowing around February and March. The issue that is raised by Treasury in terms of we did not notify them is because of the procedure that Treasury follow during the adjustment estimate. When you request for additional funding during the adjustment estimate, they look at your actual expenditure. At the time of the period of the adjustment estimate around August, September, indeed, the department had low expenditure, and there was no justification in terms of them going forward to say Home Affairs will require that 92 million that was promised for rollover. It occurred, and in terms of their criteria to allocate additional funding during the year, you know, during the adjustment estimate. Indeed, our figures were not favorable for us at the time to really bid for additional funding. But we knew that there were accounts still going to be paid. Because, Chairperson, our expenditure, especially on capital aspect, is not a linear expenditure. Projects take off, you know, at different times, and you will have spikes. I mean, when they indicate that we motivated fully for the reasons for the spikes, reasons which I'm citing now, we indicated exactly which particular item. I mean, there was even a suspicion that we were dumping funds towards the end of the financial year.
Mm.
But I mean, audit that was conducted, even the reasons that, because we were up to a point of indicating when was the order placed, when did you get the invoice, did you get the goods or services that were delivered. Chairperson, in a 20 or 30 page document that we provided with supporting documents to National Treasury, we cleared that part.
Now that was good, and I think that was necessary to clear that suspicion. I think from where I'm standing, I would also have thought that probably it was a case of fiscal dumping, and it was good that we were able to clear that and explain that. But from where I'm sitting, I think I would not want us to use the term technical unauthorized expenditure. I suppose we'll deal with that in the normal way. We'll interact with Treasury, and no Treasury will come back to us on how we deal with that aspect. My last question is on the forensic investigation. Where are we with that process? What is happening? What has happened?
Chairperson, as I've indicated, I've got some challenges when it comes to responding to some of these questions. As I've indicated to you, that I took office in October.
You'll be surprised that there were head DGs who appeared before us, having been in office for only weeks.
Yeah, no.
March now. So from October to March should be about five to 6 months.
Yeah, Chairperson, I don't dispute that. What I'm trying to say is that in the year under review, some of the things that we are discussing about, I'm not definitely familiar when it comes to the technical part of it. I mean, no, the generic, the...
Yeah, no, what I'm asking is, apparently a forensic investigation. What has happened to that investigation? Is it concluded? Is it still going, ongoing? That's what I want to know.
Chairperson, the forensic had two parts. The first part was concluded, and it gave rise to quite a number of other aspects which required in-depth investigation. Because at the time when it was conducted and the way in which it was scoped initially, it was to look at with internal. But the findings touched on service providers in state, even, you know, where officials connived with the service providers, which required an in-depth investigation.
Who is doing the investigation for you?
It's done by a company, one of the accounting firms. I don't know whether I should mention the name. George, you want to mention the name?
Yes, sir.
Chairperson, my name is George Khorakwang. I am heading the financial administration. Forensic audit, as the CFO has mentioned, has two phases. First one has been concluded. Disciplinary processes are taking place. Phase two, the audit has been finalized. We plan to submit the report to the accounting officer this week, and we are here. The presentation will be made next week when you get to the office. And then on Monday, I did the review, final reviews, which they followed up so that they can be able to make the final sign-off, because I was reviewing the forensic audit with the SABDNT as well as NSDNIA. As I'm speaking now, the report is ready. We have prepared a presentation to the accounting officer and the CFO, and after they have gone through the report, the minister, together with the deputy minister, will be advised on the content. And then from there on, we will take recommendations of the report further, which is going to affect other stakeholders in the government. Thank
you. But why have you not been briefing Mr. Shabalala?
As you said, we have to get permission to answer. Then he was about to explain to you that I'll take the call, the issue about forensic.
All right. Okay. No, that's fine.
I just wanted to add that the reason why it takes, I think the explanation I was giving, the reason why it took long is because of the complication it had.
Right.
Because it required the specialists in systems,
okay,
in order to dig certain information.
Okay. That's good. Then we hope we'll have access to that report. We do appreciate that Home Affairs, by its very nature, will be very attractive to corruptive practices. And that does the need for the department to have sufficient capacity to be able to discharge of its responsibilities. A slight area that has witnessed supervision, it's a gaping hole for corrupt practice. Thank you very much. Comrade Bonhomme.
Thank you, Chesterton. The statement in the qualification in question, Chesterton, there's quite a number of initiatives that we've taken. to deal with the issue. First is to put the necessary systems in place. We have computerized, or rather installed, the basic accounting system in 146 offices. This is a system that...
How many are still outstanding? Because I think there are no
offices that are outstanding that can be computerized.
What does that mean?
This implies that...
There are offices that cannot be computerized.
There are offices that cannot be computerized, which is not of our making, but because there's no telecom connection. Because this computerization is online. It's something where you can put a computer.
How many such offices do you have that cannot be computerized?
Well, I would say it will be something like 25% of the total that has been.
You gave me numbers and you have put that BAS in about 140.
Yeah.
Now, how many are not computerized in numbers?
Close to 70.
Close to 70.
Yes.
I see.
Other interventions in terms of the SOP, standard operating procedures. We have put standard operating procedures in place. Provinces have been given that. We have put monitoring systems in terms of revenue collection. There's almost weekly reporting from each and every office in terms of the revenue they collect, but also confirmation in terms of deposits that they have made. We are linking up with banks. From head office side, we are in a position to monitor what has been banked by each and every office. And we give warning in areas where we feel today, I mean, we going through the report on a day-to-day basis, there's a specific staff members who are actually given the task to follow up with offices.
All right.
Where they see there's some,
okay,
some problems.
All right. Okay. Now that's fine. But then that obviously excludes the 70 offices or so that are not linked to your PAS system.
Yes, it's only for PAS, but otherwise the procedures that are followed are applicable to all offices.
Okay.
Their only challenge is that they don't have a facility to capture receipts, but we also have contingencies in as far as that, because they actually capture at the nearest offices, which are not far. I mean, the distances are not far. The 146 offices are in a position to accommodate those offices that are not linked.
Come back, no?
Chairperson, I'm quite clear in my mind that we've made a concerted effort to put everything in place. But the issues that we've indicated, which are still a challenge, issues of capacity in terms of staff, because systems go with human capital, in terms of people who must also operate behind those systems. That part, Chairperson, is a part that is still a challenge that we are dealing with.
Okay. All right.
Chairperson, if you don't want me to monopolize the meeting, I'll allow...
No. Actually, Mr. Shabalala is the one who is supposed to be answering all the questions that are put in the department. I mean, I see that in the organogram, before he became acting a DG, he was in charge of... he was a deputy director in charge of civic services branch. So he's not a new person to the department altogether. And obviously, having been called to come here, we would have expected you people to have prepared
terms of knowing the areas of concern from a financial management, from a finances point of view. We certainly expect him to provide leadership at this point in responding to this question. So I expect Mr. Shawala to respond, and not the CFO necessarily, unless if we're dealing with technical and detailed matters. But general questions require his responses.
Chairperson, I concur that I must give leadership. As I've indicated, when it comes to technical issues, that is why I've got my lieutenant, who knows the area of operation. But generic question, definitely, I'll have to.
Yeah, there is a question. Have you done a comprehensive risk assessment of the department or in the department?
Yeah, we've done that, and we're currently continuing doing that.
Sounds more like a mere statement than, you know, a consistent report.
Chairperson, I'm responding to the question that says, have you done an in-depth study? I'm saying we are currently involved in the process of reviewing the risk assessment in close collaboration and the support from the intervention task team from the National Treasury. Chairperson, can I again, with your permission, ask the CFO?
Now, let me get a response from Treasurer.
Chairperson, you'll recall that last year the Minister of Home Affairs, I don't know whether he requested, I don't know how to put it correctly, but did ask for help from the Minister of Treasury in terms of the section in the PFMA, I think it's section 2.8. And in that, then a team was set up, an intervention task team comprised of the Treasury, the OPSC, and the DPSA. Part of the scope of the work of the financial side of that team is to actually look at the risk assessment of Home Affairs. That work is being undertaken. As we sit here now, there's a cabinet committee meeting where the human resources and organizational management side is giving back its report back to that cabinet committee. So yes, there is work being done in collaboration with Home Affairs in risk assessment.
All right, thank you. So indeed, there is something that is being done, COVID or not. I think Mr. Shabalala just gave the... I think let's keep that one. That one has been responded to during my time of questioning in terms of what is being done with internal audit.
Chairperson and honourable members, in the event our officials are charged for fraud or criminal, fraud or theft or misappropriation of funds, there are procedures that are to be followed in terms of the labor relations. And when a person is found guilty, we should give a sanction. We have got quite a number of examples that we have dismissed our officials for these nefarious activities. So yes, there is a process whereby when our officials are involved in corrupt activities, steps are being taken against those officials. Chairperson, what happened is when the minister invited the support intervention task team, the team was split into two. There is the administrative part of it, which was led by OPSC, and the financial part led by National Treasury. both reports will be presented to Minister, and thereafter will be tabled to Cabinet, and the results thereof will obviously be communicated to us as management of the department to make sure that we embrace those results and the recommendations, and then we operationalize them. The task team, which is responsible for finances, will be making a presentation to the minister as well as the deputy president. That's what I heard from the accountant general yesterday. So we haven't heard anything as officials, but hopefully after that process, we'll be informed of the recommendations, the results, and we will act accordingly.
All right.
Chairperson, yes, it is functioning properly. However, we've got a challenge now because the chairperson of our audit committee has just resigned. We are in the process of recruiting and appointing a new chairperson of our audit committee. But it is functioning properly.
Right, thank you, Comrade Bonong. Comrade Vincent.
Thanks, Chair. Just to touch on an issue that was discussed just earlier on, let me talk about the accrual. On page 124 of your financial report, or I mean of the annual report, 124. There's an accrual of 42 million. Now, 25 million of that 42 million, page 142, note 19. At the year end, there were no services received or goods bought at the year end. That's what the Auditor General tells us. Now, accrual means that you have benefited from services and or goods, but you've not received the invoice and therefore you raise it. That's what it means. The Auditor General is saying for 25 million rand, neither had you receive the services or the goods. So you actually inflated your expenditure. That's what it means from where I'm sitting as a layman. And therefore, I'm suggesting that you did do fiscal dumping. That's what I'm suggesting. If that statement is correct, then you did do fiscal dumping. Because you can't raise an expense if you've neither received the goods nor the services. 25 million rand of it. And at the end of that financial year, I'm suggesting that you did do fiscal dumping. What is your comment, accounting officer?
The person I would humbly ask your permission to allow CFO to respond to the technical question.
Thank you, Chairperson. If you allow, I would just comment by indicating that government is operating. Yes, indeed, the finding is correct. Let me just indicate it. But let me deal with the question of whether this was fiscal dumping or whatever. Government is accounting on the basis of cash accounting. It's modified cash accounting. And in terms of modified cash accounting,
the question that I'm asking, sir, at the end of the year, did Home Affairs enjoy the benefit of 25 million rand? That's the only question I'm asking, yes or no. And if you didn't, I'm suggesting that you can't raise an expense on it. That's the only question. Let's forget the modified, let's forget anything else. My question to you is, there's an expense that has been raised for 25 million rand. The Auditor General is saying, no services were given to the department. Neither were there any goods that you had purchased. Now, in my mind, accrual means that we've received those things and invoice hasn't been raised. Therefore, we are raising them because it's happening this year. My simple question to you is, for that 25 million rand, have you received any goods or services? And if you haven't, I'm suggesting that you reverse the 25 million rand. It's simple as all that. That's what I'm asking you, and I'm saying to you that if you don't, then for me, these books are not reflective of the truth.
Chairperson, the starting point is that accrual doesn't imply you've received the service. Accrual implies you have a commitment. You have a commitment. Accrual implies that when I say I accrue expenditure, is when I've said to the service provider, you shall provide the goods, and therefore in my budget, I commit the funds. It doesn't imply I have received the goods. That's why I was explaining the basis of accounting of government, which really, in terms of the modified accounting, we have to indicate what commitment we have. I think what has not been stated correctly is what commitment we have. In fact, we had not even committed according to this finding. And that really, yes, we have rectified the error, but really it's not a financial transaction that you might regard as a loss or irregular or something like that. It's a non-compliance in terms of disclosure.
All right.
No. Okay. Fine. We'll have to ask the Auditor General because I want to refer you to page 101. If you page 101 in your annual financial statement says, accruals represents goods and services that have been received, but where no invoices have been received from the supplier. And that's how I understand accounting. That's how I understand it. There can't be this argument of yours because there's a separate section for commitment. If you've made commitments, it's a separate section. Accrual is another section. So I'm suggesting to you, sir, that 29 million of your 49 million rand, if I go by this book that you've prepared, by the way, and I read on page 101 and I read on page 124, then I'm suggesting that what you wrote in the book and what you're telling me contradicts each other. And I'm just asking the question. Of this 42 million, 29 million rand, you had not received any benefit. You have not received any benefit. That's all that I was saying, and you are putting it as a clue. If you've not received the benefit and you've made a commitment, then show it as a commitment. Don't show it as an accrual. And I'm suggesting that the AG must help us in my interpretation of that. Because a commitment and accrual are two different things in my book. Maybe the AG's office or treasury or somebody must assist me in this regard.
Yeah, let's start with the treasury, then we'll come to the AG's office.
Chairperson, the understanding of Mr. Smith is correct. I think in a letter written by our Director General to the former Director General of Home Affairs, I have a copy here, the following issues have been identified. There is evidence of fiscal dumping in the form of transfers, and this is likely to have a negative impact on service delivery. Capital allocations intended for capital projects, including infrastructure, are being diverted to standalone assets, such as vehicles and computers. There also appears to be some payments being made to service providers prior to the delivery of goods and services.
Thank you, Chair. You know, yeah, I'm going to go through a whole list of these things. I'm actually very frustrated. I'm wondering whether we should ask this department to redo these books, because what Treasury is saying to me, and my understanding of it, is that it's not worth us going through what is happening here, because even the department now is disputing what is going through here. So I'm saying at some point maybe we must ask the question, is it worth our while calling the department to come and account to us on issues that even themselves are disputing, and it's in their science, but they must note our frustration, because I think we are very frustrated at this point. Let's go to the other matters of systems, Chair.
Just a minute, Comrade. Do you want to still make an addition on the explanation made by Treasurer?
Chair, perhaps just very briefly, I should just say for the record that we agree with the Honourable Member's interpretation. And we don't think that commitment should be taken into accruals. We agree absolutely with the understanding of the accruals that's being put across here. Thank you.
CFO, so you're raising your hand. Can I say something?
Chairperson, if on page 101, I'll just make the statement and then finish. Exactly where the Honourable Member has been reading on 5.3. If you continue there, it indicates very clear that accruals are not recognized in the statement of financial position, which is your income statement, where your expenditure goes. And it says they are not recognized in the statement of financial position as a liability or as expenditure in the statement of financial performance. Your statement of financial performance is your income statement, and your statement of financial position is your balance sheet. Now, the point I'm putting forward in terms of the definition of accruals, I still stick by it.
Sir, can I ask the accounting officer? In the financial year that we've passed, this 29 million that is in question, how have you recorded it in terms of spending, overspending, underspending? Because I don't want to have a discussion and a debate with the department. I want you to tell me, how have you reflected that 29 million? Have you reflected it in terms of your total budget? Has it gone as an expenditure? Doesn't it reflect anyway?
According to the information, it hasn't gone as an expenditure. That 29 million.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to your banking system, sir. The Auditor General says to me, you've got an alien banking account where money is deposited, and when certain conditions have been complied with, that money is refunded to the person responsible. That account has not been audited since inception, and we're talking about 280 million rand. What is the state of affairs now?
Chairperson, indeed the account has not been audited.
It's not going to be audited, sir. I'm talking about today. You see, Chairperson, this thing is not the matter of today. And I think Mr. Bonham was correct. This department is in crisis. And we continuously hearing, well, we are still working on it. There's been a task team in place. I think the department, if we want to help you, sir, must be able to say to us, it's not been done, or we've done this, or these are the difficulties. That's what we want, so that we can take a decision as to how we assist you or how we recommend. I mean, that's what we want. I don't think we want explanations, Jefferson, because we've got the facts. We just want to know what is happening from now forward. That's why I'm not asking you what has caused it. I'm asking you, what are you doing about it, so that we can fix up the department.
Thank you, Chairperson. What we are doing currently between us and the Auditor General and the Accountant General, we are looking at the guidelines in terms of the format of the financial statements that needs to be presented, Chairperson. And the Accountant General and the Auditor General and ourselves are actually going to finalize this matter. And the coming audit is definitely going to deal with this account. Thank you.
Your recording of revenue, as at this financial statement, or the financial year end, your services rendered and your products sold were not reconciled to your revenue, and therefore the Auditor General couldn't verify your revenue. What is the state of affairs in terms of revenue reconciliation today? Are we comfortable that if your revenue reflects 10 rand, that is the money that indeed is owed, and you've got supporting documents to that effect?
Mr. President, I will request the Director for Finance to give that response.
Thank you, Acting DG. Chairperson, the revenue management in the department is administered at provincial offices. And then we'll give you a document that is explaining how the recording, receiving, and depositing of this account is taking place. But what is currently happening, the issue that is raised by the Auditor General is, after an office has collected revenue and bank debt, there are exceptions that are coming because your receipt part that you've addressed in the opening that says, after you've deposited money into our deposit account, it must come with a corresponding receipting part. That receipting part did not take place because in other offices there is no basic accounting system and people did not. As I'm speaking now, there are six teams that are all over the country that are helping our provincial offices to allocate it. Money has been collected, but day ending and receipting was not taking place. We have arrested the problem. We are working on it. By year end, we'll be in a position to reflect an improved situation compared to the 49 that was lying as unreconciling items.
You said earlier on to the chairperson that there were 49 departments that had not been automated, or 49 regional offices or something, 75, something like that. What are you doing in those instances? Because what you are saying to me, and my understanding, is you collect money, you're unable to capture it so that it's reconciled. Those must then be manual. Somebody collects money. Where do those receipts go to, and who's capturing them?
Chairperson, I'll give an example. Take an example, Johannesburg. We've got Market Street and we've got Wynberg, Wynberg in Sandton. Wynberg has no capturing facilities. Every day when they collect the money, they deposit daily. Then the exception that we've been qualified on rises. Then on a weekly basis, they go to Market Street in Johannesburg to go and capture those receipts so that the exceptions can fall away. Meaning every office where there is no fully fledged finance team or audit office, they are capturing those receipts at the closest office, and then the monthly returns are submitted to head office for reconciliation.
Thanks. Let's go to your garage or your expenses on motor vehicles. First of all, previously, you paid for 559 cars, vehicles. he only took receipt of 455. That's 101 vehicles short. Has that situation been rectified?
Chairperson, thank you. That situation has been rectified. Those vehicles were delivered. We have them in our asset register.
At the time, what caused the problem? I mean, there's no way that I can go and buy a car in a garage. There's no way that you will buy a car in a garage with your own money and not take possession of that car at the time. Now, I'm saying 101 cars is not one car. Can you explain to us how did that come about?
It's 104.
No, no. 104 vehicles, I beg your pardon, yes. Just what caused that problem at the time, that it had to be picked up by the AG? What was the reason? Was it the timing or what was it?
It was definitely the timing, and it was also the timing in terms of delivery. They were not purchased from the garage. They were purchased from Gauteng government transport. What happened is we transferred the money, the amount, during the financial year. That was 2004-2005. In anticipation that they will deliver this vehicle by the end of the financial year. When the audit was conducted, not all vehicles were delivered at the time. They were indicating that they could only find those 400 and something, and the other cars were not delivered. It was definitely a timing issue, Chairperson.
Okay, this is not a timing thing, you see. The financial year end is the end of March. The auditors come there in May. What? The CFO is saying to me is that they transferred the money before the end of March, because the financial year end is the end of March. 2 months later, the cars aren't there. I'm suggesting to you, Mr. CFO, there's no way that you will pay for your... You see, the problem that I have is that you're not operating this department as if it's your money, because there's no way you will pay 2 months down the line. The car is not there. What you're saying to me is that you pay, the auditors came, and they come 2 months, if I understand correctly, April, round about May, is the day. At that point, we still don't have the cars, but the money has been paid. I'm suggesting that it's poor financial management. Even if you got it later, I'm just suggesting that it's poor financial management, and it could be one of the mechanisms used by departments for fiscal dumping. Because you put that money in, whether the car comes in June or July, from your records, you paid for the car. And I'm suggesting that if this is the practice in your department, you better cease with it as soon as possible, because we're going to check it out. If your reason is correct, then it must be the case, sir.
I'm going to, hopefully I'm not going to be out of order here. We are confusing two issues. 2004-05, it was issue about delivery of cars. That has been there in the report last 4-5. 5-6, Honorable Smith, is running cost of those vehicles.
No, sir.
This
no, through you, Chairperson. I know that very well. I was asking the question. I said that. And I'm saying to you, whether it was 2004 or 2005 or whether it was 1994, if what you I'm hearing is what has happened, then it was wrong even then.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting to you that it happened in this year. And Chairperson, I don't want to debate this matter with these people. I'm saying this is what the Auditor General is saying. You can shake your head as much as you want to, sir. I'm suggesting to you when you come to Parliament, you give us the necessary respect. If not, then you must leave this place. I want you to explain to me, sir.
Thank you. Chairperson, I agree with the Honourable Member. But just to indicate that it happened due to the circumstances. Government garage does not order a vehicle when you have not given them the amount. They don't order it. So we had to, in anticipation that there will be deliveries, pay that amount.
Vincent is saying that the auditors came in May, and in May, by May, 104 of the vehicles that you have purchased were not there, which means
you actually had paid for these vehicles towards the end of the financial year. By May, when they came in, those vehicles were not there. I think that is the point, and let's leave the other part out. That is the situation. Right. Okay. Yeah.
Sure. This financial year, there were expenses of 61 million rand for, I would assume, claim for Trevor. But there were no reconciliations done between kilometers traveled by a individual and the monies that you paid them. How are you doing it today? How do you pay people? On what basis do you pay me if I come and claim for petrol today? Because then that was the situation. 61 million rand, according to the Auditor General. There were no reconciliations, but I'm not interested in that. What are we doing today?
Today, Chairperson, we receive log sheets. There's an electronic log sheet system that is operating throughout the country. Before we pay government garage, the running costs of vehicles are paid to government garage. So they are run by our offices. We get confirmation from our respective offices in terms of the kilometers traveled, the log sheets and all that. And then we then make a transfer to government garage.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Chair. Let's move on to funds surrendered. And I want to refer you to page 122. You, according to note 13, and note 15, I just want to check what note 15 says, but according to the AG's office, you indicate that you surrendered to the National Revenue Fund an amount of 236 million rand. However, the actual amount surrendered was only 223 million rand. That's 12 million rand that is unreconciled. Why did that happen, and what has happened to that 12 million rand?
Thank you, Chairperson. The allocation, I mean, the money that has been collected by the department throughout the Republic had to be allocated to revenue items, and at the time of the financial year end, the total has not been clearly allocated to because of unreconciling deposits and so on. As I'm speaking now, my team members are allocating that, and the payment is going to be made to NRS. Basically, what was happening is that records were not yet matched to the deposit, and the process is taking place, and then journals are passed to the relevant item, and a total payment of 12 million together with additional revenue is going to be made this week.
This week?
Yes, sir.
Going to be made this week. This is something that happened in March. This is something that happened. When I say something, I'm saying this audit was as the financial year end, March 2006. The auditors came in May 2006. We're talking about March 2007. This is when this is going to happen. Now, I'm glad that it's going to happen. I'm suggesting to you, sir, that we can't wait 12 months. 12 months. Let me tell you why we can't wait 12 months. You see, that 12 million rand that must go to the revenue fund is the money that pays for my mother's pension. That's what it is. So your delaying makes us unable to deliver services as the ANC government. And we're not going to tolerate that. So your argument of it's going to happen this week is actually not acceptable. It's not acceptable. And I don't want to hear any excuses. I'm just making that point, Chairperson. And it's 12 million rand for due, and if everybody had 12 million rand of the 36 departments, it's a hell of a lot of money that we can't afford to be lying around because of administrative weaknesses. And this is what accountability is about, and this is what we're going to hammer you about, and this is what we're going to fire you about. Let that be clear. We'll fire you for this. Because it's not acceptable that you can have 12 million rand lying for a year and you come to Parliament and you say you're going to do it this week and we must accept it. But no, you're going to do it this week. It's not acceptable. It's absolutely not acceptable. Let's move on, Chairperson. Let's move to receivables, Chairperson. Note 16 indicates to us that there are monies received and are in excess for 2 years. Now, Section 38C of the PFMA, accounting officer, 38C1 of the PFMA, says it says that the accounting officer, the accounting institution, must take effective and appropriate steps to collect all monies due to the department, trading entity, and so on. Can you explain to us why do we have debtors of 2 years and more? And in your view, do you think that an outstanding amount for 2 years is effective collection? Because that's what the law demands of you.
Chairperson, the committee, I think, firstly, they have to understand the receivables that we are talking about. How do they arise? They come from, since the Alien Control Act that says anybody that ferries a person without proper documentation, the department, in terms of Immigration Act, is now levying fines and penalties to airlines. This is mainly the major part of this. And this amount stems from 1996. And as I took office in 2005, we started recording, reconstructing the accounts to see what exactly is this. And we realized that most of the payments, as I'm speaking, have been paid, but they were not allocated to revenue items. As I'm speaking now, we are in a position to reflect proper records that says what has been collected and paid and fines that has been issued. And in as far as we are concerned, that was poor management of data. And the problem has been addressed. And the person that was in charge of the account will have to explain to the committee or to the DG why did he or she not do this. And it's been corrected as I'm speaking to you.
Can somebody explain to us, Chairperson, I'm rounding off, can somebody explain to us what makes up the staff debt of 3 million rand? And I'm talking to page 121, notes to the financial statement number 11. 3 million rand, 3.4 million rand is staff debt that is older than 3 years. Can somebody explain what that is about?
Thank you. Staff debt arise as a result of In some instances, the department provides study loans to staff members. And in some instances, we find that they don't complete their courses, and in terms of the provisions, those amounts need to be deducted from their salaries for serving members, staff members. In some instances, we will find that staff members have resigned. Maybe they still have that debt. And it is not cleared, or they have moved to another department, but the deduction is still continuing. Those are main areas that constitute your staff letter.
How long is acceptable for your department to have a debtor's book in terms of years? What is the acceptable norm? I'm asking purely from an ignorant point of view. Is it acceptable to have a 10-year debt in your book? Is it acceptable to have a 3-year debt? What is an acceptable norm as the Home Affairs?
Well, the acceptable norm, it depends on the arrangement with the relevant person in terms of affordability to deal with it. But under normal circumstances, you don't really allow a deduction for more than 12 months.
Can you pick up then the 33 years? Because this is 3 years. You're saying not more than 12 months, and I concur with you. We're talking here about 3 million rand for more than 3 years. Can you guys go there and have a look at it, review it, and collect the money from those that you need to collect the money from before they leave, so that you take their pension before they leave. Can we do that?
Yes, we will try, Chairperson. But there will be, for instance, instances where, yeah, but we will try.
My final question then, Chairperson, is this thing called suspense and clearing accounts? Personally, Vincent Smith has a serious problem with suspense accounts. It cannot exist in government. You have something like 7 million rand unclear. 7 million rand unclear. Now, it's indicative of the poor financial management we have. We don't have supporting documents, so we can't allocate. We can't do our revenue because we can't allocate. We've got credit amounts of 49 million rand in our bank account because we haven't done all the allocations. We've got this suspense account. It worries us in SCOPA. It worries us in SCOPA that we have all these type of things, which are basic things that I think you learn in accounting 101. You can't have a suspense account. I accept that I go overseas, you put it there, when I come back, I give you the money, you reimburse it accordingly. But when it moves to a figure of 7 million rand of money that we don't know how to deal with that money in the suspense account, it worries us. Can somebody indicate to us what is the level of suspense accounts across the board in your department, rand-wise, a thumbs up? What sort of figures have you had that haven't been allocated either way?
Chairperson, we've got the revenue suspense account and expense suspense account. On the revenue one, we are sitting with 61 that is on the bank exception and 10 million on the deposit. This is the total that the team is clearing as I'm speaking to you now. And then on the expenses, the total value of the revenue expenses is, I calculated it, I did not reach my machine, is anything, is 10 million, which relates to records that we are clearing as I'm speaking.
Thanks, Chair. I've done my business, but can we ask this department to come back to us with your progress on your suspense account? Because everything is happening now as we come. That's fine. We would want you to come and give us an indication. That task team of yours, how far have they gone in clearing the suspense account? How far have you gone with your debtors? And how far have you gone with your alien bank account? Okay. Because those are basic system problems that we would want fixed up. I can assure you, Department of Home Affairs, that we are going to call you back in the next couple of months. We're going to call you back. And then I think it's going to be a different ballgame in the next month. It's going to be a different ballgame. So can those things be cleared so that when Lily and her team come to you in May, that at least these things have been dealt with. And we don't have a situation where Home Affairs has qualified reports for 5 years in a row. We will call you back next year.
Right, thank you, Comrade Vincent. Mr. Comrade General, welcome. Welcome. All right, Comrade Mashian.
Professor, my question is around the capturing of information by the central office utilizing WineBet. What is the problem? Why doesn't Centen have its own capturing system? The one you were trying to explain earlier on. Or is it maybe also a problem with telecom connection lines or something like that?
Yes, we did. I think it was just an example that you cited. But with specific, there's an office that had to relocate. I think you are citing this example because of the relocations circumstances. There's an office that moved to another office and they could not therefore capture because they were not connected at the time. They were still trying to sort out the issues of telephone and all of that. But in the rest of Gauteng, it's not a challenge. The challenge I cited in terms of telecom lines and whatever is not a challenge around Gauteng.
All right. Okay. No, fine. It's a challenge in the outlying provinces, like where we come from. We would want to round off this engagement with Home Affairs, but as Accountant General, I think we certainly are interested in getting just in 30 seconds your impressions or the progress that your task team is making in its intervention in the department. Unfortunately, it could not be around. We got the explanation fine, but as you would note, we have had a lot of issues to raise. But specifically, we could not raise the question, your intervention, are we making progress or not? I asked the ship was sinking, or is floating, or is still floating, but is it sinking slowly now than before? What was the situation?
Thanks, Chair. Thanks for your preference. I unfortunately had to attend another engagement later on. I think it would be very brave to make a statement that says it's no longer sinking or it's sinking slowly, but maybe to refer to what is happening in specific terms would be better. Yeah, I think it's safer to make a judgment call than making a judgment call. But I think, as can be evidenced by the questions and the responses that are coming out of this meeting, it is clear that there are serious challenges in the department. Having gone there in an investigation, I think I'm beginning to appreciate that it is not necessarily a simple department, but obviously there are basic things that can be done right. The approach to the investigation, of course, was twofold. One is to look at what is happening currently and try and work with the department to improve that. And I think that's why sometimes the officials, I mean, not that they were doing nothing completely themselves, that's why sometimes the officials are saying that, okay, that one, we are addressing it. Hopefully in the audit will confirm that, or at least confirm progress in some of those things. So the approach was twofold, that we deal with the issues that you can address immediately, but at the same time we try and focus on the investigation and find out what the problems are. We had focused on the investigation in twofold. I think in due course, maybe in the coming week or so, the minister will make pronouncement in this regard. And I would want to take that which the minister has to do, but I'll make just a few general comments around it. The areas that needed immediate improvement have been identified and discussed with management at Home Affairs and corrective action taken. The outcome of the corrective action can only be seen, obviously, once the auditors come back in and look at what is happening. Some of the problems are somewhat of a legacy, and legacy in the sense of, if you look at people that are sitting at Home Affairs trying to make a change, and then what they need to deal with in making that change stick and work. And then some of the initiatives will take time to bear fruit, but other initiatives will obviously be very immediate. When the report of the minister comes out, where he talks about capacity issues and so on, you will see that there will be areas where there could be quick gains, there will be areas where you would need to take a bit of time to get back to that point. The various areas that were raised by the Auditor General last year, we've dealt with those areas in the investigation, confirmed some of them, and obviously recommended to management for certain action to be taken, and that action is being taken. There are areas that we picked up that may not necessarily have been in the regularity audit that we've dealt with. Again, we've dealt with management in raising those issues. clearly, in an environment like Home Affairs and other departments that are having problems, you have corrective action that is nice and that can help build people and so on, but you may, in certain instances, have corrective action in areas, and the department did its own forensic investigation, and there are disciplinary action that is taking place as a result of that. So there may be those areas where there's a need for that. So part of it is correcting the controls and making sure controls work, making sure everybody understands the controls. Part of it is saying, here you don't need to put controls, but also at the same time you need to get people to understand that certain things are just not supposed to be done, so they don't repeat that. So the investigation, yes, has had a report. We presented the report to the Cabinet Committee this morning. There are still other areas, focus areas that we're still investigating further. That will report to the Cabinet Committee and the Minister later. And in those areas that we reported on today, there have been specific recommendations that have been discussed with management, at least from the point of view of the financial management section of the investigation. I can say that without fear of contradiction, that we've discussed with management, we've deliberated with them in terms of what they need to do, in terms of what we can support them with. In the other areas, I can only say I believe those discussions did take place. So I hope that, Chair, there will be some change. Change is painful by its very nature. So as the change takes place in Home Affairs, there will be times when it's uncomfortable for the officials, uncomfortable for all concerned. And we can expect some such outcome. But I've got no doubt that the problems in Home Affairs are not insurmountable. As can be seen from the cleaning that Honorable Smith was making, some of those points are points that can be rectified and corrected. Challenge may be the issues of skills and capacity in various areas in Home Affairs, but they can be rectified and they can be dealt with. How soon is a question. The ship will be rescued, whether it's sinking now or not, I cannot pronounce on that, but I can say it will be rescued.
So there will be no need for life jackets. All right. Thank you very much. We want to thank you, Mr. Shawalala, and your team for coming through and responding to the questions that were put through. Obviously, we are not part of the TAP team, but certainly we are part of those who want to assist and to see the department move to more calmer waters, so to speak, and the responsibility lies with each and every one of you to ensure that the right things are done. You know the laws, the rules, the procedures and policies, and ensure that things are done correctly. I mean, Home Affairs is a very strategic department in government. Not that there is any department that is less strategic, but certainly Home Affairs is, and it is one department we certainly cannot afford to have in a state of, instead of chaos, or perpetual chaos, as it appears to have been. And the responsibility and the challenge is on you, whether you're just going to be, you know, part of the moving in cycles, or you're going to break the cycle and get the department to move on the straight line towards success. Thank you very much, and we certainly do not wish and hope to see you here again in the next financial year. But if there are challenges, we'll certainly call you, especially on all the commitments you have made. We're going to do this, we're doing this, we're fixing this, we'll fix that. We'll be interested to have a look at those commitments that you have made. Thank you very much. We will have a comfort break for 2 minutes. There is tea outside. Exactly 2 minutes. When we come back, we have to look at the government printing work.
Chairperson, I'm going to deal with the governance and capacity. Perhaps just as we have been listening to the department, and apparently problems are similar in this entity because it is operating under the department.
So it's like mother, like daughter?
Yes, like father, like son.
Oh, okay.
Chairperson, matters reported in current and previous years. Let me quote a sentence from the auditor's report. There is lack of effective and efficient steps to collect money timelessly, compounded by lack of skilled and competent staff, as well as management reviews, which resulted in poor management of debtors. Unquote. Chairperson, the question of management of debtors in the printing works people are talking about challenges, and I see there are more problems than challenges. Now, with regard to management of debtors, government printing works has got challenges in the management of debtors. For 2003 and 2004, just to give you the idea, there was a disclaimer on this aspect of management of debtors. 2004-2005, there was also a disclaimer with regard to management of debtors. And 2005-2006, the auditor expressed an adverse opinion. So you can see what's the graph going up or down. I mean, in terms of seriousness. Now you see what measures are put in place to salvage the entity, because as you see, the three previous financial years, it has been really bad. The auditor expressed, I'm sure, all the opinions. I'm not very sure what opinion he's going to express now in 2005, in 2006, 2007. Could we be taken on board as to what the situation is now?
Honorable Chairperson, my name is Tom Moyani. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Government Printing Works. Together with me today is the Acting Chief Financial Officer.
Just said that the Chief Financial Officer is suspended.
Chief Financial Officer has been dismissed.
Oh, dismissed.
Yes, Chairperson.
All right.
Chairperson, the questions that have been raised today are pertinent issues that we are confronted with. And would like to indicate that from the previous financial year, Government Printing Works has been receiving disclaimers. And it's not a nice situation to be at. And the issue of lack of effective and efficient steps to collect outstanding debts is a sore issue, which we as Government Printer have taken on board. Would like to indicate that in the previous financial, the current financial year under report is that we have got an adverse opinion. Would like to indicate that that is a slight improvement from a disclaimer in the previous financial year for the past 3 or 4 years. But be as it may, the question that you're raising, sir, is what steps have been taken in order to arrest the process of lack of efficient and effective methods of debt collection? We have taken corrective measures. We have, since the annual report was prepared, taken on board the services of a consultant to deal and empower people in terms of what needs to be done. Internally, we have two people who have been allocated the task of dealing with specific issues.
One, debtors in particular, with regards to invoicing, correct invoicing, order capturing and processing, allocations, clearing of suspense accounts, statements and reconciliations being done timeously. On the second aspect, we have a person that deals with debt collection per se. Debt collection team has been expanded to 9 people as we speak. We have monthly letters that we issue to government departments and service and people that we have business with, indicating where their debt status is. We've also taken measures in terms of giving ultimatums to government departments that have not been paying in accordance to Treasury regulations and PFMA, because it is not good for us to be providing service to government departments who at the end of the day are not paying themselves. But what was key in order for us to unlock this problem was that for a number of years since 1996, we have been having outstanding debts which have not been cleared and money not being collected, to a point wherein it was difficult for us to understand who is owing what, and therefore we decided in this current financial year to disaggregate accounts. The old accounts are kept separately and monitored, and have introduced new accounts wherein we can account for and money is collected timeously.
All right. Okay.
Right. thank you, Chairperson. In fact, the emphasis here was not that much of collecting the debt. It's a question of competent staff and skilled and competent staff. Because what Mr. Moyane has been saying now was compounded by lack of competent and skilled staff. So he says we are doing this and that and that and that, but he doesn't say anything about skilled and competent staff. I think that should be the emphasis. Or whether he suggests that the staff is now skilled, the staff is now competent when he says you are collecting debts, you are doing this and that and that. I think I'm more interested in skilled staff.
Chairperson, the question of skills and competency, how we address this issue is that within the department, the questions of skills, we have trained our own people internally so that they are skilled in terms of dealing with the effectiveness and efficiency of debt collection and identification of the customer base that we have. But there is still a challenge that we need to indicate that the current staff complement that is in the finance division is that it's a staff that has been brought from different printing works post-independence in this country. They came from the TBVC states, and some of them came with skills that said they were this. In actual sense, they were not at that level. But what we have done from a human resource perspective is that we have taken some of these colleagues for further training for them to be understanding what issues need to be done within the debt collection section. So the question of skills will be an issue as we're going forward, but it is being addressed on a regular basis by training and also bringing other people in terms of providing them with the competencies that they need to.
But you see, Mr. Moyane, I think the point being made is that despite this ongoing training that they are talking about, you have not had the necessary competency to sufficiently capacitate you to manage your finances accordingly. I think that is the point that is making, and I think that is the point. We are not winning the battle, are we?
I would say confidently, Chair, that if we were to look in terms of the debt, our exposure, our debtors, it was sitting at 155 million, and we are currently sitting with 75 million. We've been able to collect 75 million of that amount. Yes, the question of competency and skills is something that will be ongoing, and we therefore believe that for us to be able to attract the best skills, it has to do also with another dimension that we'd like to deal with. It is a challenge that we have, but with the current staff complement that we have, we need to do the best that we can
But we take the point that the question of skills is still an issue, but we need to put corrective measures currently in order for the organization to survive the onslaught of uncollected money.
I'm just interested in knowing where those people are. You say they come from the TVB states. Have they been within government or they've been hibernating in those states?
Chairperson, with the incorporation of different government printing works, we still do have some staff members who come from the previous dispensation. But it's not an issue to say if you come from a previous dispensation, you're not capable. But what we are saying is that there is a need for us to have a core team that deals with issues of the financial management as required by National Treasurer and in accordance to the PFMA. Okay. We still deal with that. Okay.
Thank you, sir. Furthermore, due to capacity, the internal auditor did not execute all the internal audit projects as planned. Hence, no reliance could be placed on the work of the internal audit. Now, still with the internal audit, on the internal audit, you received, the government printing works received emphasis of matter for 2004-2005, still emphasis of matter, and 2005-2006. You could see, you know, there is a trend. I talked about the disclaimer, adverse opinion, or, well, quite acceptably, adverse opinion is better than disclaimer. Now, here you have three consecutive emphasis of matter on your internal audit. What have you done to rectify this?
Chair, before we took over in 2005, 1st of April, GPW did not have an internal audit team when I took over. And therefore, it is logical from your assertion, sir, that in the previous financial years we got emphasis of net on internal audit 2003-2004, 2004-2005. It was only towards the latter end of 2005 wherein we had a recruitment of people, of a colleague who took to head the internal audit unit. Indeed, there are challenges in that regard. And therefore, all we are doing now currently is to recruit the requisite skills in terms of beefing up internal audit. Because without internal audit, therefore, you cannot be able to do your audit plan, your risk assessment, and then for that is a huge challenge, and it's a big problem for an organization of our nature, not to have an internal audit team. It is not completely and fully staffed, but we'd like to believe that in the current financial year, we shall be able to provide more people within the team to deal with this matter. It is similar to the issues that you have raised previously in terms of the skills and efficiencies within debt collection. It is a legacy that has been there, and therefore would like to try and arrest that process. And we can indicate to this committee that it's an issue that we are quite unhappy about, but we're putting everything possible in order to have a strong audit team within the organization, given the nature and the amount of money that and contracts that we push within that organization.
All right. So, Mr. Moyane, you are saying, what should we expect during the coming financial year? What kind of an opinion do you think the auditor would express?
It's very difficult to answer, but I would like to believe from where I'm sitting, and I would like to have a clean report. But that, for us to achieve, it needs more hard work has to be put in place. I would not like to promise this committee that I'm going to have a clean report, but the ultimate that the organization, any organization, would like to have is a clean report. I've indicated, sir, that before we took over 2005, it has been a legacy and string of disclaimers. So when we took over, we had a relief of having an address, which is a slight indication that there are changes within the organization. hopefully, all things being equal, and the work that is being currently done within the organization, we might get a better report. But that is subject to us putting more emphasis at leadership level, that okay. These issues that have been indicated are dealt with.
Okay, now that's fine. I think it's talking about a year ending in a few weeks' time. So I don't, there's much more of what effort you've put than effort you can put in the remaining 2 weeks or so.
Yes, you see, I had thought the previous report would have made them, would have cautioned them earlier, I meant to improve. But the impression I get is that the internal audit is not that much correct just now. It's only that you are trying, but you don't want to promise. Right. Risk assessment and fraud prevention plan is not yet approved, implemented, and monitored. And again, there was an emphasis of matter for those three consecutive years. You see, I have tried to simplify this thing so that we understand each other. You could see I had wanted to find out about management of debtors for the consecutive years, and then internal audit for the consecutive years, and now it's a risk assessment and fraud prevention plan. It has the same problem for the last year, for the previous 304, 303, 304, 304, 305, through and 405, and 04, rather 05, 06. The same number of years as you talked about the legacy, and I see all those things were uniform. So what is it that you are doing about the fraud prevention plan?
In the absence of a strong internal audit, you have a problem because you cannot have a risk and fraud prevention plan. But the team that is currently operating, we do have currently a risk and fraud prevention plan. We do have currently, which means that when the auditor giant comes to our environment, they'll find that plan is in existence for the year that is ending in about 4 weeks. We do have that in place. So despite the efficiencies of the past and the effectiveness of the team that we have, the current staff and the team that is within the internal audit has within this period been able to elaborate a policy and the risk assessment plan and the fraud prevention plan within the organization.
All right.
That we can give a test to.
All right.
Let me get this clear. Have you recruited some people with expertise, or you are training people within? What is it that you are actually doing to rectify all these things?
We have recruited people with the skills in that particular field, sir.
You just said that your internal audit function is not yet up to a level where you can confidently say that it is doing its work effectively and efficiently.
I'm saying, given the nature and the size of the organization, the effectiveness of the people that we have, they can keep the organization running. But from where we are sitting, sir, we would like to have a team that is very strong in terms of, we have only two people, internal auditors, who are qualified. The others are not at that level. And therefore, we believe as we go forward, we'll be able to have a very strong team from a perspective of where we want the organization to be.
All right. I think the main area of interest is, since March last year up to now, if not explaining what happened in the past and why it happened, what measures have you taken in response to this report in terms of your own initiatives to correct things? I think that's our area of interest. We don't want to talk more about the future. We want to talk more about efforts that have been expended since the report came out. Yes, Rupul.
Chairperson, I'm surprised that Mr. Moyan doesn't hope to be having a good report in the future. You are saying we may not talk about the future, but the past is the stuff with which to make more future the past must prompt you, know, to prepare better future. So I'm wondering why you don't want to commit yourself. Well, not necessarily committing yourself, but you seem to hope against hope that, you know, things will be correct. Having recruited some skilled people with skills, I think you should be having a positive expectation. Now, the budgeting process, no compliance with Treasury regulations. For this non-compliance, you had emphasis of matter during the same year as mentioned. Something along those lines, what is it that you are doing?
Chairperson, firstly, let me say that we are an optimist organization. We are, if I may go back before I answer this question, I don't foresee a situation wherein we have a disclaimer in the current financial year. I don't foresee that. When I said I do not want to commit myself, it was in terms of to whether we'd have a clean report. I would like to have a situation wherein we can maintain, avoid a disclaimer in our situation, move away from a disclaimer to a situation where we have a clean report. But be as it may, the audit team will be in our field and be able to assess. I am confident that with the team that we have will deal with this issue. But in terms of the budgeting processes, everything is done in order to have a budget process within GPW. We do have a budget process that is done according to the precepts of the law, and we are in compliance in the new financial year that is going to end in 4 weeks' time. We will be compliant.
The control environment. What improvements have you done to your control environment? Having had this emphasis of meta for, well, you have recently had the adverse opinion, as you say. I'm not very sure. There's emphasis of meta, no opinion, an adverse opinion. That is what you have been getting now. What improvement or what measures have you in place to rectify your control environment? That is how you run your entity.
With regards to control environment, we have taken corrective measures to a number of issues as per the report of the Auditor General. One, it refers to the fixed asset register, which was a problem. Two was the VAT. Three was unpaid suppliers. And it's a string of aspects which the Auditor General is mentioning here. I would like to indicate to you, sir, that the control measures that were put in place is that during the current financial year, based on the report that we received from the Auditor General, we have written off assets. Assets have been written off, and general entries have been done, and we have done all the reconciliations that are necessary in accordance to the precepts of the PFMA. With respect to that, we've also taken corrective measures to reverse the processes that have been identified by the Auditor General. The same applies to the unpaid suppliers. We have done that, and we'd like to believe when the Auditor General comes to environment, these issues shall have been addressed appropriately.
All right. Rapule, you still have questions? You still have questions?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, just interesting that the vacancy rate you said you recruited people. I say in terms of that report, levels 1 to 2, I wouldn't express them in percentages because they are very relative. They don't seem to show the magnitude. Now, you had 486 and you filled 276 were filled. 210 posts were vacant. I would be interested to know how far you are. Even under level 3 to 5, level 6 to 8, level 9 to 12, level 13 to 16. I would have an interest there. You have just 8 posts. I don't know whether those were funded or they were unfunded posts. You had 8, you filled 3, and then there was a vacancy for 5. I'm just interested in knowing how far you are with the vacancy rate.
Chair, this is a huge problem that I would like to put forward here. If you look at the annual report, it has the establishment of 1,004 positions. But in reality, when you look at GPW, these are the posts that were established and approved in the previous years. Now, the problem of high level of vacancies is precisely because some of those vacancies have become obsolete and redundant. Allow me to explain why. Now, if you look at the government printing works giving its own...
Maybe let's ask questions this way. Are vacancies not a problem to you now?
Chair, they are a problem, but not to this magnitude. We do need expertise within the organization.
But what are you doing about this shortage of expertise or of warm bodies?
Yeah.
I think that's what we'll be interested in. Measures they're taking to address the situation.
Very difficult to put into perspective. One is that as much as we train and the experts that we have within GPW, because of its manufacturing nature, we have a difficulty of attracting the best skills within the GPW because the level of remuneration that we provide is not in line with what industry levels are. That is a huge challenge.
What are you doing with that huge challenge?
That huge challenge, we train people at the same time, but they're continuously being poached by the private sector.
No. I hear you. I get that. What I'm asking is, you have that challenge of salary differences or remuneration differences,
yes,
which results in you leaving people after training them. Say, what are you doing to address that? Is there any way of addressing that that problem?
Well, the process of addressing this issue is will be covered under the corporatization of GPW. Currently, as we speak, we have done the job evaluation of the entire staff in accordance to the level and of expertise within the organization. That seemed to have had an effect of breaking the process of people leaving the organization. But medium long term, we sincerely believe that we'll be able to stop the bleeding within the organization as we migrate from the current status of the organization into a new institution.
But it seems that this migration has been long in coming. It seems just to be hanging somewhere in the air. Is it ever going to reach finality?
We'd like to believe, Chair, that it's going to have finality very soon.
Why do you believe so?
Because we have already presented to the Minister, the Deputy Minister, the business case for corporatization. We've also presented to the Minister, the Deputy Minister, with the bill. We've also presented to the Minister and the Deputy Minister with the proposed plan in terms of the appointment of the interim board.
All right. Okay. Yes, Sita. Okay. Thank you, Rapul. Commissioner Chef.
Thank you, Chairperson. I particularly have dealt with most of the issues that appear in this section of the GPW. I want to go to information technology. There were significant weaknesses which were identified as the following: an IT security policy which has been drafted but had not been approved by management or implemented. Furthermore, the password and logon controls for the financial system were inadequate as users were not prevented from sharing passwords. And the drafted change control policy document had not yet been approved. Segregation of duties was inadequate since developers had access to the financial system's data and programs. A formal comprehensive disaster recovery plan had not been developed to ensure that business could be resumed promptly after a disaster has occurred. And the last one being, an IT strategic plan had not been approved and implemented to ensure that IT service delivery would remain aligned with the business strategy and requirements. And the root cause of all these things is policy not approved by management and no implementation of policies. But at the same time, I think this could also, in a way, tie up with the high vacancy rate that you have, especially in terms of implementation. Could you explain to me and make me understand the situation at hand and what you're doing about it, and why some of these things are not being done?
Thanks, Chair. With respect to the issue of information technology, point one, we'd like to report to this to the committee that an IT policy has been approved as we speak, and that was a work that we dealt with immediately when the issue was raised with us, because it has serious implications in terms of the operationability of the organization. Now, with respect to the draft changes control policy document not being approved and segregation of duties not being done, we have since done that and we can attest to that situation. Now, where we have a serious challenge, and it's an issue that we'd like to put very clearly here, is a comprehensive disaster recovery plan. We're working on that, and it's an issue that at EXCO level, at senior management level, we have discussed with our IT colleagues, that we can ill afford to have, not to have a disaster recovery plan, because if things fall apart, there's fire within the organization, things will fall between the cracks. We are addressing that, and we have an IT committee that reports to me, and they will be able in a position to provide us with the way forward. They are busy with this issue. We don't have as yet a place where all these documents and files are going to be kept, but we are addressing the matter as an issue of agency. An IT strategic plan has been approved as we speak. Now, in a nutshell, what I want to indicate here is that some of the issues that have been highlighted here was taken the seriousness with which they deserve and try to address them. But it's only one that we think it is very critical and very serious. The disaster recovery plan is one that we still struggle with, but we're working on it. It's not something that we've put aside. We are working on that.
The last part of my question was related to your vacancy rate in relation to these problems that have been identified. Do you think that you have adequate person power?
Ma'am, I would like to your question to be within the IT or within the organization?
Specifically within the IT.
We interacted with the Department of Home Affairs with a previous colleague who was a DDG on IT to have an assistance in terms of men in that section, precisely because we see it as a critical point within the organization.
So in short, you don't have...
We don't have sufficient capacity in IT, but we do have people to deal with the current needs of the organization. Yes.
I'll then move to cost of sale. The report on page 147, item 3.3, right at the top there. It looks like there's a lack of understanding of the accounting calculations conducted by the PECAS system. And in this regard, that is why we have the cost of sales being understated by 519,168. And, Datumia, what is happening here?
Ma'am, let me say this. We took a position. And I would like to indicate that we have since recruited a cost accountant so that we have a clear picture in terms of our chart of accounts. This has been a problem that has been for a number of years. We would like to believe that the corrective measures that we have taken on board involves, amongst other things, that we revise our chart of accounts and do the collections correct allocations and identification of what is it that is included under cost of sale. And also the other issue was...
I think the question has more to do with the impact of the corrective measures that you have taken. Do you think that the corrective measures that you have taken will be sufficient to ensure that this does not arise as a problem going forward? That's the area of, that's what we're interested in.
I can say absolutely yes, we have taken corrective measures so that it will not appear again.
Right, thank you.
And it's around the property, plant and equipment. In note 1.1 of the accounting policies, it is stated that assets without a book value, but which are still in use, are revalued according to their historical cost by realizing their annual depreciation against income and increasing their replacement value through the machinery and equipment fund. For the year ended 31st March 2006, an amount of 4 million, and for 2005, it was an amount of 3 million, was charged to the income statement as opposed to being debited to the relevant asset account. It is submitted that only the depreciation on the revalued amount should be charged to the income statement rather than full revaluation amount. The root cause is that they being non-compliance with South African GAAP.
May I take this opportunity to allow my acting chief financial officer to provide you with substantive information on this matter, with your permission, Chair.
About the assets, it was actually incorrect journal entry that was passed, and it since has been reversed, and the manner that we dealt in the previous years, it was incorrect. So we corrected in this current year by reverse that transaction that was passed. So what we're actually doing is we use the incorrect general ledger account and not taking it to the asset account as such. But it's been rectified, and it has been rectified.
Okay, fine. But thank you, Comrade Michelle. Yes, Comrade Pierre?
Thank you, Chair. I just have a short question. This is on page 164 of your report. Yeah. If you can look there, then you see a 20 right at the top. So, have you got it there? It says there, the core business of the government printing works is the provision of printing and related services to government entities across all spheres of government. As the government printing works is a trading entity operating within the borders of the Department of Affairs. My question to you is, and you don't have to answer, but you can just rectify it. Because I would like to make the request, maybe you have not thought about it, but seeing the work that we do in terms of delivery, it will be really assist us a lot if members of parliament could be supplied with a state tender bulletin which comes out every week or every second week. It's about 35 rand a year, but if you can just rectify that, thank you.
We appreciate the comment, and we will take it on board. We shall certainly comply. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. We again want to express our appreciation to Ryan and the acting CFO for coming through to us and assisting us through some of the hazy and misty areas of your work. As you'll be aware, It is not a good state of affairs in the government printing works, and we can only hope that measures will be taken to or measures that have been taken so far are going to produce better results going forward. And we also hope, Ms. Chabalala, that the corporatization of this entity is going to be speeded up, because I'm looking at a corporate resolution that was passed for the financial year ending 2004. And one of the issues that were raised there was the corporatization process, which we said has to be finalized as a matter of urgency, and a progress report be sent to us within 60 days after the resolution is announced by Parliament. And today, we are told that this is going to happen very soon. It has not happened. So we seriously want to say that we want to see this matter finalized as urgently as possible. We don't want to pass resolutions in Parliament that are meaningless. Government officials need to act on those resolutions. Thank you very much. And wish you all of the best in your endeavors. I think we're done with Home Affairs and its siblings. So you are free to leave. Unfortunately, we have limited space so that you can have others. Thank you very much. Get started. We would like to welcome you, gentlemen and ladies, from the Africa Institute. Oh, okay, no, fine. We heartily welcome you and want to apologize for the time delay, but we get paid for talking, so once we get into that business, we usually go on and on and on and on and on, and we may equally go on and on and on and on with you. But it is always in the interest of trying to get things cleared out. Our usual formality is this introduction, so that we know who we're dealing with, and then so that we can get started straight away into the business of the day. We would like to hand over to you to introduce yourself, and then we'll take it up from there.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good afternoon, honorable members. I would like to introduce the delegation. I'm Thabiso Mogudi. I'm the Chairperson of AISA from 1st January 2007. I'm accompanied by Mr. Jezigen Naidu, who is the Deputy DG at DST, and he's also a council member of AISA. Next to me here is Professor Bobby Subrian, who's the acting CEO of AISA, and he started acting on the 1st of February 2007. With us is also Mr. Stan Mabusa, who's the acting CFO from May 2006. We have a number of colleagues here from the DST also accompanying us, and I'm going to ask Mr. Naidu just to introduce them briefly.
Thank you, Chair. We have on my left the Chief Financial Officer from the Department, Malakha Hukwani, and we have some colleagues from the Ministry as well, and I'll ask them to introduce themselves. We're rather afraid of SCOPA, so we thought maybe we'll come in numbers.
Nelvis Kakema from the DST.
Mputin Hokong from the Minister's Office, Science and Tech.
Selim Bele, Parliamentary Officer, Minister's Office, DST.
Thank you, Chairperson. That's our team, I think.
All right. That's fine. From the AGIS office, the chair knows all of you.
so you're not doing it for me.
I'm Simpi Wekle, the corporate executive at the Auditor General.
I'm Ajit Salik, I'm senior manager from the AG.
Lily Zondo, corporate executive, Auditor General.
Yeah, Kekunana, Auditor General.
I'm James, I'm a senior manager of the Auditor General.
Okay, thank you. Do we have members? May those members introducing themselves?
Gerard Koornhof, COPA.
Anshin Dreyer.
Vincent Smith.
Babi Kilepule, COPA.
Pierre John Carver, Scopa.
Andy Becker, Scopa.
Ronald Mufugin, Scopa.
Don Kumede, Scopa.
Well, thank you. I'm Comrade Temba Goji. I chair this committee. Before we start, Mr. Parliamentary Officer, I think earlier on we're speaking at Cross People. I'm referring to a completely different DG from your DG. But nonetheless, the fundamental line that communication should have come directly to us prior remains the standing order of doing things. Would have appreciated that, whatever the circumstances. Right. That having been sorted out, I will hand over to Ms. Dreyer. But before that, to again welcome you to this interaction, apologize for the time delay, and to indicate that an interaction with us is probably one of the simplest and most enjoyable. All we're interested in is information. You have the information, we want clarity. Because for us to be able to process the annual report, be able to write a report to Parliament, there are areas that we feel a face-to-face interaction might assist. And the Institute obviously plays a very, very important role, not only for the government of the country, but insofar as it seeks to relink us back with the continent, that we are not some part of Europe in Africa, but we are part and parcel of the continent. And to the extent that that function is of strategic importance for the country, we certainly do take a very keen interest in the effective delivery of its mandate by the Institute. And I think you will agree with me that the kind of media attention that the Institute has attracted at in some instances has not been very positive, not been very good. And the report for which we have called you here certainly does not make for good reading. And the number of acting this, acting that in the Institute itself does indicate some element of not so stable an institution, which then has a not so positive impact on quite a whole range of things that have to do with the ability of the Institute to deliver on its mandate. And I think it is out of that concern that we have sought this audience with you. But I'll hand over to Honorable Dreyer. Dreyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the Africa Institute for South Africa, of South Africa, received a qualified audit from the Auditor General for the financial year under review 2005-06, mainly due to the lack of skills and major upheaval at senior staff level. Now, I just want to give a few examples to indicate the upheaval at the senior staff level. You've only been appointed to this position a very short time because the previous chairman of the board set down at the end of November 2005. correct. Okay. Then ISAR had, more importantly, more seriously, had five CEOs in a matter of a year, during that year under review. And this is on top of the fact that the position was vacant for a period of 6 months. So there was a very high turnover. That takes some doing. ISAR had three CFOs during the same year, with the current incumbent also just in an acting position at the moment. And then if we look at the core business of the institute, namely research, we see that the research in that position is a vacancy level of 35%. In the internship program, which is where the researchers are being trained, it's kind of supposedly, you know, being prepared to one day become researchers in their own right, there's a vacancy level of 30%. And I think anybody would agree that this situation looks very unstable and it's not desirable at all. I want to know from the council, and therefore to you, Professor Ogudi, what steps has the council taken to rescue this ailing institute?
Yes, thank you for that question. It's very true that it has been highly unstable, you know, in the last few years. And we have had a few acting CEOs. I don't think as many as you've counted, but we have had a few acting CEOs. And I think the most important thing is that we have now advertised the position so that we get a full-time CEO. And, you know, we have a short list which we are processing now, and before the end of April or May at the latest, we will have a permanent CEO. So as far as the CEO is concerned, we are stabilizing the situation, and currently, you know, we do have, Professor Subrian here, who is, you know, whose mandate is to stabilize the institute.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
This also applies to the position of the acting.
Yes, so I omitted that. You know, both the CEO and the CFO positions will be filled in by the end of May.
Okay, now I want to ask, it's all very well and fine to advertise and appoint the group people, and that's what you have to do. But how do we know they won't be there for a couple of months and also they move on again, maybe a more attractive position offered elsewhere? Are you putting incentives in place or to try and retain the people once you've appointed them? Do you expect some sort of commitment from the people to commit for a certain minimum period of time so that you can, in fact, achieve the stability that you desire?
Actually, to put it this way, why did you have so many acting CEOs for such a short period of time? After Dr. Maloka left, you had Mr. Tole, from February to April, and then Mrs. Moloto from May to June, Professor Adar from July until January. Oh, until August. And from August to January it was completely vacant. And you only have Professor Subrian as from February. Why that high turnover? Which then addresses what she's asking, that, I mean, it's fine, you have advertised, but what guarantee do we have that you may appoint somebody and in less than no time that person has left as well?
Chair, there's no doubt that ISA needs a serious, you know, turnaround. There's no doubt about that. The situation is very unsatisfactory. But just to explain, you know, the several CEO, I'll do that partially, and I hope, you know, my colleagues will also help me here. The substantive CEO was suspended in January of 2006, and there was a case against him which we were investigating. This took very long. But we immediately, at the time we suspended him, we immediately got somebody to act who was not sufficiently senior. So we had to sort somebody whom we thought was, you know, a little bit more senior. We did get somebody in the name of Ms. Kate Moloto. But unfortunately, you know, she was a consultant and her fees became extremely exorbitant. We couldn't we couldn't sustain her. Maybe, you know, Mr. Naidu here can help me with the rest.
Okay, well, with that water on the bridge really is history now. What we're interested in is how are you going to retain the people once you've appointed the new people? And do you expect them to make some sort of commitment to stay at least for a certain minimum period of time?
Yeah, we can't force people to stay in AISA. What we have to change is to change the environment. The working environment, you know, the morale has been very low. You know, so we are looking at a total, you know, turnaround plan and a recovery plan for the institute. So it's not a question of asking people to stay. I think the conditions have to be conducive for people to want to stay, you know, in any organization. So we are hoping as a new council, first of all, we have to look at the governance of AISA. It has been very unsatisfactory. We've put together, you know, all the subcommittees and we hope that the governance will improve. We need to look at the conditions of service and so on and, you know, hope that, you know, we will refocus, the, you know, AISA on the mandate that it's supposed to do. And researchers can only stay if, you know, they're enjoying the research they are doing and fulfilling the goals of AISA.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move on to the forensic audit that has been done. You mentioned that there was an investigation and that was at the time when the previous CEO was suspended, Dr. Maloko. That was in January 2006. Now, we see in the annual report here that the Auditor General tells us that the report was brought to the attention of management for corrective action. I want to ask some further questions around this report that obviously has been handed in to you. According to my understanding, this report focused on certain allegations, serious allegations of financial misconduct against the CEO at the time, that was Dr. Maloko, during April and March, when this report took place. Is this correct? Then the AG has further submitted his report with findings to the board for corrective action. That's also correct, because that's in the report. You can see that report. Okay. Now, tell me, did he find that there was misuse by the CEO of the entity's garage card and the credit card for his personal use? Was that one of the findings?
There were no substantive findings. I'll ask Mr. Jessica Knighty to assist me in that.
What does that mean?
There were allegations, but there was no conclusive evidence to substantiate those allegations.
Thank you, Chair. Let me assist Professor Goody. The forensic audit that the Auditor General did was the substantive document based on which the disciplinary proceedings began. But as with all such proceedings, one would have to hear both sides of the story before a conclusion is reached. The AG's report certainly indicated that there were potentially these misgivings. But before that disciplinary procedure was completed, the incumbent had resigned. So we had not had the opportunity to conclude that process to come to the conclusions that Mr. Hay is talking to. If it has been completed, it's possible that those would have been the outcomes.
I understand that the disciplinary hearing did not reach a conclusion because the CEO at the time then resigned. But the Auditor General, in his report, did make certain, he came to certain findings on which he made recommendations. And I'm just checking on those findings of the Auditor General, understanding that it wasn't a disciplinary hearing or a board of law. But I'm just focusing on the Auditor General's findings of his investigation. So I take it then that he did find in his investigation that there was a misuse by the CEO or indications of misuse by the CEO of the entity's garage card and credit card for his personal expenses. Can you just say yes?
It was in the report.
Yes. Okay. Now that's all I need to know. Thank you. Did he also find, I'm referring to the Auditor General's report, that there was misuse of the entity's motor vehicle and trips undertaken for the private use and benefit of the CEO? And then further, is it also correct that the AG found that there was misuse of petty cash for the private use of the CEO.
Yes, true.
Okay. I have one or two more, Mr. Chairman, and then I will carry on. Is it further correct that the AG found that the CEO does not make a declaration of a conflict of interest in various organizations?
But in one of them, the AATS, I think it was found that actually there was no conflict of interest. But there was another one in which there was potential conflict of interest.
Okay. And then lastly, is it also true that the AG found that the CEO overruled procurement policies, also including donations being made to organizers of international conference without the proper approval?
That is true.
Madam Chairperson, then you would agree with me that these are quite damning findings.
Yeah, they are serious allegations. Very serious.
Very, very serious. Okay. Now, let's come to the disciplinary hearing then. So based on these findings by the Auditor General, you then started a disciplinary hearing. But by then, the CEO was already suspended in January 2000. The hearing also only took place in August of that year. By that time, the CEO has been suspended on full salary, I take it, for, what was it, 8 months. So he did nothing and he received a full salary for 8 months. And then he resigned just before the disciplinary hearing reached a conclusion. So he avoided kind of maybe a negative finding. Very nice position for him to be. Now, clearly that's unsatisfactory. I want to know you as the counsel. What are you doing or what have you done to hold that CEO accountable for his deeds?
I'll ask Mr. Nagy to answer that question.
Chair, I think that we must represent this the way it happened. The charge sheet, and I can't recall the exact date, the charge sheet associated with the disciplinary hearing was submitted to Dr. Maloka's lawyers very early in the process. The reason why the disciplinary hearing, as far as it got to, took as long as it did, was in the nature of these things, and this committee will be very familiar with it, you can't compromise people's rights, that they actually have to be available for a sitting for that to happen. There were issues about communicating through lawyers. This is not something that we collectively are used to. The normal disciplinary hearings is much more direct, but in this case, senior counsel was used by Dr. Maloka, and that caused further complications around the calendar. It was certainly not ideal for either the council or for the Department of Science and Technology for this to drag on. In theory, this should have been a 3-day hearing with a conclusion. But when those 3 days actually happen, follow the prescripts according to the law, and the person who is accused has certain rights. The second thing to clarify is that the disciplinary hearing got as far as the plaintiff in this case, the counsel, presenting most of its case, not all of it. And at the point where it was terminated because Dr. Maloka had resigned, the defense had not yet started responding to that. So it would be unfair of us to say that a conclusion was close, because one still had to hear the defense. It is certainly not ideal that this was not concluded. It is a matter that this new council has to sit and deliberate on and examine what options are actually available to the institute in order to pursue this, because clearly it can no longer be a disciplinary hearing because the person is no longer in the employ. But there are several other mechanisms that might be available to be used. But I think until we've taken advice on those issues, it would be hard to comment on that.
What I want to know is, are you going to allow him to get away with it, just resigning at the convenient time, or are you considering options, and what are these options that you still have available to you? We need accountability here. People can't just do things like this and then get away with it and say, oh, now they've resigned, and then they move on and probably go to another government entity and repeat the So what options are you considering at this stage?
Can I just say that the new council has just had one meeting. It's a totally new council. We had one meeting on the 2nd of February. That's the first time they received, this forensic report. They have to familiarize themselves with that.
we have this on the agenda of the meeting of the 16th of March.
But what has the department done? It looks like the department did nothing since the resignation in terms of looking at various options, since the institute was not functioning optimally.
I think that the department has done several things. Firstly, we have to be clear that the minister needs to empower the council to conduct the affairs of the Africa Institute as the executive authority with a minimum of intervention. Having said that, various competencies inside the DST were used to assist with the shoring up of AIFA at the time, including the financial competencies.
I'm talking about this specific case of the outgoing CEO, that after his resignation, in terms of looking at alternatives, since the institute itself was obviously handicapped, the department did not do anything in that direction. That is why it is only now in the agenda of the new council, and we're talking about August, now March. And
well, Chair, in that period of time, and the council will tell you this, that there was a collective management of the institution using whatever was left of its management, the council and the DST. All of the issues associated with the various people that were running the institute at the time were jointly assisted by DST and the council.
So the focus was more on salvaging the
institute. It was very important to do, Chair. The issue around what happens to the allegations associated with the previous CEO needed the following responses. One is to have the kind of governance and management systems in place in order for that never to happen again. And I think the chair will explain to you, in fact, she has organized a presentation on what the response strategy had been.
All right.
And okay. I think we can say with confidence the opportunity for that to recur now is extremely remote. In fact, a lot of the focus of the first council meeting was exactly that.
All right. Okay.
The second issue is that for the department and the minister in particular, he has to get a recommendation from the new council as to how they want to proceed on this issue.
Okay.
Because there's also an issue of cost benefits involved in whatever option
indeed,
you want
indeed,
to
indeed,
embark
indeed.
Upon.
The question I would like to answer that by a question and say, what is the price of combating corruption? Because we might need to pay a price to investigate and pursue a matter further to its logical conclusion. But maybe at the end of the day, that is worth it if we send a strong message out that people won't get away with stealing the taxpayers' money or abusing the taxpayers' money. So sometimes that may be worth it. Mr. Chairman, but the problems don't end with the CEO. The CFO at the time was also suspended in February 2006, and he then resigned in July. Now, I don't want to go into that because, you know, we'll have probably similar stories. We don't have a lot of time. But I want to ask the people, the CEO particularly, you're considering various options, but have you considered or are you already... Have you recovered some of the money? Are you charging an interest on that money? Over what period of time? How are you monitoring it? All of these questions are options that you can pursue in the meantime without you know, laying charges with the SABC or thinking about criminal charges. You can at least in the meantime try and recover the money. Are you doing any of those?
Chair and Madam Dre, I think the thing that will have to clarify this issue a little bit is that the suspension of the CEO and the special leave associated with the then CFO and the subsequent irregular suspension of the COO were all related to the same issue. In fact, the person who had been, if you like, the whistleblower around this whole issue had in fact been CFO. And that was the complexity associated with this thing, that the entire top management of the institute disappeared in a single shot. And what was left to do for the people who were left behind, including the council, was to shore up the institution in a way that its overall performance objectives were minimally compromised.
Okay.
And I'd like to submit, Chair, that such a presentation was made to the portfolio committee in this very room around the performance in that period of time. I think Mr. Sale was there, and I think we can all happily say that we managed to hold that part together quite succinctly. But the issues that Mr. Ayer is raising now are the ones that we're currently grappling with. Now that we've organized for the ship not to sink,
okay,
we can now deal with those more succinctly.
Okay, all right.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I hear what they're saying. I have some sympathy for that, and I understand that. But then, to stop it all, you paid, or the council agreed to pay performance rewards to various people, but including that CEO and the CFO, despite the allegations of financial misconduct and mismanagement and the pending disciplinary action. The CEO received an amount of 34,613 rand, and the CFO received an amount of 24,773. Now, I can't understand this. It doesn't make sense to me. I know this is the kind of thing that the ordinary people out there, that's what makes them very, very angry. Now, does your entity have a key performance measurement policy in place?
We have a performance management system.
Now, if this policy is in place, then is this sufficient to pay the performance of the bonus to the CEO under those conditions?
I think that is a bit odd, but Chair, the reason I'm asking Mr. Naidu to respond is I was out of the country from August until November 2006, so I'll ask him to respond.
Thank you, Chair. I have big question marks on my eyebrows around this thing, because I am actually not aware of that. As best I know, there were no performance bonuses paid because no performance assessments were completed on those individuals. I think we'll have to investigate this. If there was an interpretation inside the Institute that a 13th check is automatic, that is obviously wrong. I apologize, Chair, but I think that's something that we'd just like to dig into. I can say explicitly, though, that there were no performance assessments completed, and the board certainly did not approve any performance bonuses for those individuals.
Mr. Chairman, now the situation is becoming odder and odder, because if there's no, you know, not aware of it, and no such decisions being taken, we have a first kind of information from the Auditor General during their audit that performance and bonuses had been paid to the individual and various other people, but these two are not interested.
Yeah, no. I think.
Then one has to investigate how did they manage to get this money. It wasn't a decision by the council.
Yeah, no. I think for Mr. Naidu, it is fair for him to say he's not aware, because he's not running the institute, so to speak. it is correct indeed that there is need to investigate this, because this is what we have from the. From the Auditor General's office, it might have happened. It might have been a practice that has been happening without following policies and procedures. And certainly, I think it is something that does need to be looked at, and probably a report be forwarded to us in terms of their findings and what will be taken to rectify the situation. I think so. I think that's how best we can handle it at this point.
I agree with you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. That's the end of my question.
All right. Thank you very much. Yes, Honourable Baker.
Chair, on the line of questioning of Ms. Greyer, I would just like to come in again on the CFO that was suspended, and that on that specific suspension, due to the allegations that the CFO has made against the CEO, which sounds normal if you are then suspended because it's now two conflicting opinions against each other. But then the CFO resigned on the 31st of July, that specific CEO. What was the specific reasons for his resignation? Because what I will lead up to that is that surely by the time that the CFO again took up his job, he should have been welcomed back into the fold, particularly since his whistleblowing was actually correct. It wasn't denied or anything like that. What has happened at that stage when the CFO, on the first day of his return after his suspension?
I think what actually emerged was that the two people were actually working together. So even though the CFO was blowing the whistle, he was implicated in some of those allegations. So we reinstated him because, you know, we felt that, you know, the CEO actually more or less, you know, victimized him as it were. That's why he, you know, he blew the whistle. But then, you know, if he stayed longer, I think he also, you know, got wind that he might actually be investigated himself.
So he blew the whistle when he did not get his fair share of the cake?
Yes, they differed over something. We don't know what it is. That's why he blew the whistle, we think.
Has there been a specific disciplinary action taken against him, apart from the fact that he blew the whistle, and that due to the fact that it would be an uneasy situation to have him not suspended at that time? Has there been direct allegations against him, can I take it as that, of misconduct and financial mismanagement?
Chair, the situation was like this, that and this is what is in the record and what we've been told, is that the CEO had given the CFO a specific instruction in December associated with a conference in Mozambique, and the instruction was not carried out. And the CEO then, it wasn't a suspension, but put the CFO on special leave associated, I guess, with insubordination associated with that event. The reason why it took as long as it did to reinstate or to reverse that decision is because the council itself needed the information, which was hard to come by, and it had to get legal opinion as to whether or not it could actually do that. I'm speculating on this part, but I imagine that for the CFO, given the uncertainty of the situation, probably use that time to investigate other options, because he started a job immediately on his resignation from AISA. So there may well be fairly ordinary reasons around why that happened.
Okay. Can I thus conclude that he was definitely not victimized because of his whistleblowing situation? Because if this is the main thing that we want to establish, that if whistleblowing is taking against corruption and that type of thing, special care should be exercised. And in terms of that, I think that such a person on his first day of return should actually be accompanied by the board chairperson or from the board, and to reintroduce him and to say, to put the position in perspective.
He was certainly, you know, not victimized by, you know, the council.
Yeah, no. I think from what Naidu has narrated, clearly it was not because of his whistleblowing.
No.
Yeah.
No. It wasn't.
Right. Can I then, in conclusion, just ask, you have a person which was called the supply chain financial manager. Was this the CFO or was this a different person in the organization?
The acting CFO to respond to that.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
and other members. That was a not a CFO, but an immediate under the CFO.
In the report, it is being reported that, and this is again relating back to the CEO, that 500 rand petty cash payment on 28 June was made to the ANC on behalf of the CEO. And this payment was authorized by the supply chain financial manager, and the cash was used by an unknown person. This sounds a little bit vague to me. In fact, if we could have some clarity on that particular aspect.
Clearly, that was a completely irregular payment. We've examined this issue, and the global response to it is to have a much tighter supply chain management regimen inside the institute. But you will also see in that report, I mean, you pointed out this particular incident, that there were a few others where the former CEO authorized his own payment, which is completely illegal. So all of those checks and balances currently exist. The rules for that existed before. They were just not observed.
I think the issue here is one of compliance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Policies can be there and be framed and all that kind of stuff, but if they're not complied with, there's no enforcement or monitoring of compliance.
The point that SCOPA is conveying to the organization is both the CEO and the CEO and the CFO, after they've been suspended, they receive these bonuses, performance bonuses. And the question is, do you have checks and balances in place for so that anyone will be suspended again? But after suspension, that to prevent any payment of performances to a person that has been suspended. Are the checks and balances in place to avoid a reoccurrence of this?
I think, you know, a number of things have come, you know, from the Auditor General's report, and this is the one we don't know about and we are going to investigate. A lot has come through. We know a lot of what has happened. These performance bonuses are a new thing. So I just want to reiterate that we have never heard of those at all. But I think the important thing is, how do we go forward from here? And, you know, Chair, the plan was to actually make a presentation, you know, to the members here. And I'll just ask, Professor Suzanne here just to give, you know, an overview in terms of the plan.
No. Let's just pack it. Members can have copies.
Can I just say one other thing? I think one of the biggest problems we had during that period is there was no internal audit function, you know, for a long time in 2006, and now we have appointed an internal auditor.
No, that's good. Okay, thank you very much. Comrade Mfokeng.
Thank you, Chair. I will just try to be short because time works more manage. We have got no time much. Pages or whatever. Luckily, your books don't show a disclaimer, and they don't have the adverse opinion, but they are qualified. I'm not sure whether you are meaning with a nice word when somebody says you are qualified, now you think that is a good thing.
Better than disclaimer.
Yeah, in the transactions of books,
qualification is wrong. So they are qualified. And they have got emphasis of matter as well. And some of those things, I think, they are shown, they are picked up by the auditor in general. Finance issues was not disclosed in terms of AC 105 and the International Acceptance Standard, Accounting Standard 70. We find that if these obligations were capitalized, the net book value of property, plant and equipment would increase by 580,432. And long-term liability would also increase by 606,000. That's at 31st March 2006. And then the and the net profit as well would increase by 26,260 for the year then ended. What answer did you come up with? Because I tried to look for an answer for you, but I couldn't find it, but I think the root cause might have been inadequate financial management. Please. What is your opinion on this? Thank you.
Professor Kubrain will answer that.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members. Indeed, there were a number of problems with regard to the financial management system's compliance and the control environment. What we've done is we've looked at the past 3 years of the AG's report and picked out all the issues raised there in the draft management letters and the matters of emphasis. And we've constructed a plan to deal with all of those issues. With regard to the specific issues the Honourable Member has raised, we've corrected the policy associated with the accounting system already. We've dealt with the question of the lease problem that we had and handed over that matter to lawyers to sort out. We've also appointed an internal auditor, as the chairperson indicated. And in consequence to that, we will address the question of the risk management strategy and improving of the control environment. Honorable Chairperson, we will submit to this committee our report that we prepared, which contains our finance recovery plan. And we'll see in that report details with regard to each of the issues raised by the AG, how we have addressed it or plan to address it, and the deadline for addressing that. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much. Furthermore, under the emphasis of matter, the financial statements submitted for audit purposes did not comply with the GAAP and generally recognized accounting practice. This evidence was found on a number of audit adjustments and disclosure changes made before the financial of the audit. What would be your response to that? Do you agree or deny it?
We do indeed agree that the financial statements were submitted in a form that had to be followed up and therefore it constitutes a resubmission. Myself and the CFO, acting CFO, have now instituted a very exacting plan to ensure that the submission according to the deadline is fully compliant with the provisions of GAAP. We've also got a pre-audit exercise going on currently in the Institute to identify some of those key issues already and address them so that if you look at our deadline for the preparation of the annual financial statement, in fact, we're closing our books at a date which will require, afford us ample time. One of the issues that contributed to that resubmission was a serious problem of capacity within the finance section at that time. The current acting CFO came in about a few days before the deadline for submission of annual financial statements. So in summary then, Honorable Chairperson, we have a plan which will ensure that we are compliant and meet the deadline for the submission of the annual financial statements, and that we don't have to have a resubmission this time.
Thank you, sir. I hope I concur with you. I think such issues should be taken care of. On internal audit, the services of internal auditors were terminated in December 2005, and we did not have any decency of trying to rectify that after you have really realized that the transactions of the books and the problems on money is a really problem. And you were already aware that since from 2004-2005, you had been having a problem on this accounting system. Now, you carry on without any internal origin. I stand for correction without any fear of contradiction. I think it was a sabotage by people. Is that right? Because there's no other reason. That you know that these books are not balancing and there's a problem here and we still have these problems, then you say, fine, let it go like that. Unless you can come up with another issue of saying that, sorry, this was not budgeted for. Then I would like to know that, what was the real problem, unless either someone was sabotaging this to have this problem, to call you again. And we are going to do it again. We shall call you again next year. This gives us a problem.
Yeah, before they respond, may we please ensure that our cellular phones are off? Because when they vibrate or whatever, they affect the recording of the proceedings. So may we please switch them off? Right?
Chair, the previous CEO, Dr. Maloka, is the one who dismissed, you know, the internal auditor. That was in December 2005, and there was a recommendation to appoint an internal auditor in 2006. What month was it? Yes.
All right. An internal auditor was appointed during the course of 2006.
Yes. There was a recommendation, you know, to counsel by the audit committee to, you know, appoint PricewaterhouseCoopers, but we found that the process that was used to, you know, to reach to, you know, that. That decision was not regular, so it could not be confirmed, you know, by the council. So that's why there was a delay in, you know, in regularizing that.
Thank you, sir. According to the Treasury Regulation 27.2, requires that a strategic 3-year rolling plan be developed and implemented. The audit firm conducted in to perform the function has not developed a strategic plan. What is your opinion on that? Can you agree with me that it's because you are not aware because of inadequate monitoring governance? Am I correct to say that, in short?
I've already said that, you know, the internal, you know, auditor was, you know, was dismissed, so they couldn't have developed a plan.
So the situation is that we currently do not have an internal auditor, do we?
We appointed an internal auditor, I said, Chair, you know, this month. Sorry, in February. And they have already started working.
Thank you very much. More than that, not to answer my comment. On top of that, the accounting authority did not conduct a regular risk assessment. The fraud prevention plan has not yet been implemented. So it goes on and on and on. So I don't need any answer to that because there is no answer. We need it to be corrected sooner. And then I expect you plus and minus 60 days to give this committee a report that has been implemented so that we can be able to put hands on that way. We don't like us to be seen attacking. I think we also need to be attacked. It's better that we should share this problem. So if we need a delivery here, make sure that on a monthly or 2 month level, give us financial payments, and then we are able to return in and to our residents before it could be too far. Thank you, Chair, on that. Then my last, my question is that, let me look on the police levels and see how the police is being done. On your financial statements. AC 125 and IAS 16. On property, plant and equipment. They were not depreciated to a residual value. Further than that, IAS 24 showed that no disclosure were made to for related parties or related party transactions. And I again agree that it's an inadequate financial management skill. And what have you done on that?
Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Member, indeed, at the time when the annual financial statements were completed for the financial year under review, there was clearly an inadequate set of financial skills operating, and that underpinned the construction of those financial statements. We've addressed that problem. We've corrected the policy questions there, and we are compiling the financial statements this time in a manner that's compliant. As I indicated, at that time, the present acting CFO was in the job for a few days, literally. We now have a much longer period to wish to address that question. And the policy environment has been corrected in that regard. Thank you.
Lastly, Chair, because of time up, on performance information. The performance information was not time up presented for audit purposes. There might have been a reason for that. Was it due to the inadequate policy and the procedure framework and an inadequate non-financial reporting system that did not facilitate accurate recording and recording of performance information? So that might be a problem. Now to touch on other issues in my closing level is that please make sure that when you give us a report, these problems of other matters of which were founded on during investigation of misuse of identity card, credit cards, personal expenses, use of the entity motor vehicles, as trips were undertaken for the private use, misuse of the paid cash for the private use of the CEO, be dealt with, please, and then we shouldn't see this thing happening again. And then let us really correspond with each other in a timely level. Be open to us. We are there to assist. We are there to be involved as well. Not to accuse you again. We don't like you to stand on a sort of to be accused indirectly of failure. We are also involved. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, my question is around 6.3, that is performance information. That is page 65 of the report. And with reference to section 20.2C of the Public Audit Act, the Auditor General has to do an audit on your performance information. But in fact, the Auditor General says, that is the second sentence, the information related to performance against predetermined objectives was subjected to audit by the Auditor General. The entity does not have adequate policy and procedure framework to manage the process to finalize their performance information for audit purposes. My question is, why is this the case if it is still the case? If it is not the case anymore, what action has been taken? If no action has been taken, what plans are there and what time frames are in place to address this problem? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Member. Indeed, at the time of the audit, the policies and procedures for capturing performance information was inadequate. We've indeed corrected that matter emphatically because in addition to it being important to meet our reporting obligations, we consider it to be a vital management tool. And given that our core business revolves around research output, we've established a comprehensive set of policies and reporting. We've finalized a week ago a template for reporting which captures information in a manner that's credible. We've also looked very, very carefully at how we maintain the integrity of that reporting system. And all performance reports will be supported by confirmations, like, for example, if somebody's published in a journal a letter confirming submission of an article, just to illustrate, would form part of the report.
Can I check with you, Prof, the information you're giving us now, is it contained in the presentation that you have prepared?
Yes, indeed.
If it's not mine, it's Comrade Kumed. I was thinking that maybe they should give us the presentation that they've prepared. And then in preparing our resolution, we'll look at the issues that they promised us that they have touched on. And then we'll be able then to make a resolution formed by what they allege to have corrected. And then we'll also check with the incoming annual report. Just coming to my mind that you know, you have a board that, or an entity that has really been torn apart, and pieces have just been put together now. They can only talk to us about what they've planned to do.
Thanks. Yeah, I think yes, because it's not only a compliance issue. Also, it may have ramifications. On the morale of staff, especially the hardworking ones, if now there's no system to, or objective system to assess with predetermined distinct objectives, then really that may contribute to the problem. But also I think the systems, I think we've got to be satisfied that they've got other systems as well, other management systems as tools. And then the activities in the report, I rest my case. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much for understanding, Comrade. I think we'd like to have copies of that presentation. All right, okay, fine, it's here. And then if there are areas that we feel have not been touched, then they fall within our resolution to say, these are areas of concern for us. This is what we need to do. If they have attended to them, they will respond back to us and finish up with further information. We want to thank you and sympathize with the situation and sincerely hope that you'll be on top of the situation, bring it under control and refocus on research. Research and research more on things that will assist us and the continent to move forward and forward ever, and not move one step forward, two steps back. You know, Lenin talks about these things. Don't need these kinds of things. And there has to be a balance, you know, between the autonomy of the entity and the extent to which the department can, you know, monitor and be able to assist from time to time. So they don't allow situations to deteriorate to a point beyond redemption, and that's when you come in, you know, like fire extinguishers. I don't think don't think we need that, that kind of situation. But we sincerely hope and wish that things are corrected and you are able to focus on the core mandate of the institute.
Concluding statement.
Let me wish you all of the best, and that should be sufficient for the day. We thank you very much, and again, we dearly wish to continue having you here with us, but you know, our faith control, our faith constraint, I say that you will have to excuse us so that you are able to deal with the following hearing. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.